On this episode of Mechs and Men, Morgan has a permit for this. Katrina critiques craftsmanship, and Dan dances with Melissa, but it's Baron Sevens that is swept off his feet. This is Of Mechs and Men, a Battletech book club. I am Kanan Hill, joined, as usual, by my two good friends, Brent.
It is me, Brent.
And Aaron.
It's me, Aaron.
How we doing, boys?
Well, I'm not waltzing around a Laren ballroom, so I consider myself amongst the lucky.
Well, that's good, because this week we're starting off part two by covering chapters 12 through 16 of the book we've been working through.
Warrior, Riposte, by Michael A. Stackpole.
Let's get into it.
Chapter 12. So, it's the 27th of December. We're back on New Syrtis, and Michael Hasek Davian is throwing a fit. This is a Michael's office scene, all right? And he's in here. He's having a bad time.
Another one.
Yeah, again. He's seething. He's very angry about the attack, right? The attack on Kittery. That's one of his worlds. And now House Liao has attacked Kittery. He has reports. This is an outrage.
They didn't let him know or anything either.
Yeah, they didn't even tell him, right? Why didn't he tell me? Good point, because it makes him paranoid. Because he's been cooking his books, right? He's been lying to Liao. He's got this whole double cross thing going on. And he's actually, now he's concerned that, oh man, maybe they're onto me. So we got Michael in his office.
His social media status is feeling paranoid.
Yeah, he's paranoid. So Michael's in his office. He's thinking about stuff. And someone knocks at his door. Then we get this scene where he's visited by Ambassador Corrigan. Remember, this is the Capellan ambassador on New Syrtis. He has been summoned here by Duke Michael. Yes, the man with the dog. Exactly. He does not have the dog with him in this scene, unfortunately. But he's a good dog, and wish he was here.
I'm sure Quintus does too.
Yes, Ambassador Corrigan has been summoned because Michael, he just wanted to have a conversation about the situation on Kittery. So then we get this scene where Michael just grills this dude about the attacks, right? He goes in on him.
My favorite part, he like sets him up. Like Michael gets a dunk for once. And he's like, the ambassador's like, this wasn't ordered by the chancellor, I swear. And Michael hits him with the, well, who actually even runs the Capellan Confederation? Because it doesn't seem like it's him. And he's like, and the ambassador's just like backpedaling hard. Like, it was,
Well, he tells him that, right, that Chancellor Liao did not order the attack. He's like, he didn't do it. He sent me here to tell you that he didn't do it.
And yeah, then, he says, if he was aware of the attack, he would have never let it go through.
That's when he's like, who's actually running this show anyway? Because keeps on seeming like it's not Maximilian Liao.
Michael asked the guy, all right, if the chancellor didn't order it, who did? And Corrigan says that it's suspected that she chose Kittery because she probably intended to provoke an attack on the St. Ives commonality because all of her sister's holdings, Candace, she has a lot of holdings in the St. Ives. St. Ives is her thing. The St. Ives commonality. It's like, it's the region of Capellan space bordering the Federated Suns, right? It was Romano, basically. It was Lady Romano, all right? Now, I do like, we have this little bit about ungrateful children. Michael asks Corrigan, oh, can't your master control his whelps? And Corrigan shoots back, well, you know, as well as you control your son, my lord. You bastard, how dare you speak to me like that? And Corrigan says, sorry, I meant no offense. I merely meant to point out what every parent of an adult comes to realize, children cannot always be controlled. Takashi Kurita is at odds with his son Theodore. Maximilian sent his son Tormano away, but hope Hans Davian will live long enough to feel the sting of ungrateful children. I just thought it was interesting. They mentioned the rift between Takashi and his son Theodore. This seems to be a whole situation, if you will. Just wanted to point that out. People talk about it. Everyone knows about it. So Michael does warn the ambassador that his people will want revenge for this attack, right? The people are upset. They are aware that there was an attack by agents of House Liel. However, Corrigan did anticipate this line of questioning, and he brought the bag, right? He brought the cash. He's like, I know. And he didn't send me empty-handed. He says the money's already in the account. He says it's swole, right? He's like, oh, dude, yeah. Your account is swole. And then Michael tells him, that ain't swole. That's a mild enlargement. I love that part.
And if you find that your C-bills are mildly enlarged for more than 4 hours, yeah, contact Comstar.
Liao sent some money. He feels bad about it. He's very sorry. And he sent you some money. You know, get yourself something nice.
Yeah.
Now, Corrigan does, while he's talking to Michael, he suggests using the attack as a justification to demand reinforcements from Hans. And Michael reminds the ambassador that he doesn't tell him what to do. He's like, "Don't. What do you do? You come in here. Don't tell me what. No, I mean, get out of here. Shut up. I'm not." Because it's like, oh, that's exactly what he was going to do. He's like, no. He's like, I'm sorry. I was just, you know, it's a good idea. You know, we can make it work. But, you know, we got to spin it. Here's some money. So that's it. Pretty short chapter, because the chapter ends with Michael telling Ambassador Corrigan to let the Chancellor know he takes no offense, before thinking to himself about how he will weaponize the resentment of his citizenry to elevate his status to the rank he truly deserves. Ha ha ha. You'll see, Hans. You'll see.
This is just another one of those chapters that we get to see Michael think that he's two steps ahead of everybody.
Yeah.
When really he's doing exactly what everybody wants him to do.
Yeah.
Here's some money. We're cool now, right? And he's like, oh, absolutely. We're cool now.
Yeah.
I'm definitely not scheming anything else. And they're like, that's fine. Whatever you want to do, man.
He believes he's the Machiavellian, but really, he's the pawn. I feel like we're back in Nagumo's office, right? This is some real, like, just rubbing your hands together.
Yeah, plotting, scheming.
Plotting, scheming.
I'm going to get over on everybody in this one. It's like, no, you're not. Like,
no, you're not.
This isn't going to end well for you, Michael.
We're just checking in on Michael. He's just doing Michael stuff. The usual. Look, you're right. It is Nagumo's office. He does enjoy looking out of windows and such, too. It's also to establish there will be no counterattack. Okay, the Kittery thing didn't spark a war. Not yet. It's okay. Everyone's fine. We gave Michael some money. It's going to be all right. Just, you know, business as usual. Carry on. Nothing to see here.
It's a real everybody lost attack, so.
I'm sure the Kittery news services will start pushing on their 24-hour cycles something completely different, and it'll all be forgotten in a few days' time.
But yeah, it's just our usual Michael Hasek-Davian check-in chapter. We're going around. We're doing the rotation. We'll be back here, right? Until next time, Michael. I see you're just doing the usual.
Brooding in your office.
Brooding, yeah.
And speaking of checking in with people, it's about time we got back to see what Dan and Morgan have been up to in the next chapter.
Chapter 13. We open with Dan and Morgan in the streets of Tharkad. It's the last day of the year 3027, and we're on Tharkad. All right, it's about to go off. Okay, it's so cool. It says Daniel Allard followed Morgan Kell's cloaked form through the crush of people lining the streets in front of the Triad. They got their cloaks on. It's cold, right?
Remember, we talked about the Kellhounds' dress uniform?
Yeah, they got cloaks.
They got cloaks.
So, New Year's Eve on Tharkad. This rules. All right. So where are we going? We're going to a party. They're strutting. I like this, how this opens. The camera cuts in, like, you know, it's just Dan and Morgan just walking. There's like a bunch of people in the streets. It's going off, right? It's like a big party. It's got to be nuts. New Year's Eve on Tharkad? Dude, I wish. This has to be so tight. I liked thinking about it. This is a cool scene. So they go up to this party, right, at the palace. They're near the Archon's palace. And of course, you know, there's a big party there. There's a big ball with all the nobles and whatnot. We got velvet rope situation, you know, guys in like suits and like sunglasses, and you know, the little earpieces with the curly telephone wire thing coming off the earpiece situation, they're LIC. So the first thing we see them do is jump the rope, right? I feel like you see Morgan go over, right? They just walk right through the velvet rope. I feel like Dan's like, really? And Dan's like, come on. And they like, but of course, immediately, of course, the security stops them, right? There's obviously a bunch of security there. So set the scene. They're walking through the streets of Tharkad. They walk right up to this party at the Archon's palace, and they just walk right through the ropes, like right past the bouncer, basically. Right? Morgan's like, no, it's fine. Let's go. And they just walk into the party, and the security is like, oh, hey, you know, what do you, hey, you know, you got some, huh? I don't know why.
We're checking IDs.
I don't know why they're Italian. Listen, the guys walk up. They tell him, you know, we don't want any trouble. And Morgan's rich voice repelled without threat. No trouble. My companion and I are going to see the Archon.
And this is like a security nightmare. Yeah. Like, this is the thing you don't want to hear is like, oh, this is a crazy person.
Yeah, like, oh, you got an invitation? Morgan shrugged. I don't need one. I'm Morgan Kell. This rules. He literally, this dude, he literally doesn't care. He's so unafraid.
Dan is immediately like,
he's so uncomfortable.
He's right? Like,
Dan is, just breathe. He thinks that, dude, we're going to get black bagged. Like, what are you doing, dude? This is insane. Dude tells him, oh, I love this line, right? I don't care if you're Alexander Kerensky, come back with the Star League army. No invitation, no admittance. That's funny. Right? That's funny.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah. That would be crazy. If that happened, bro, that'd be wild.
Shout outs to the SLDF who left, wherever you are.
Maybe we'll see him again one day.
Maybe.
It's only a little more crazy than like Morgan Kell showing up out of the blue.
Crazier things have happened.
I love what Morgan says, though. He hits him with the, you do not understand, but I forgive you for that. I've not made myself clear.
He slipped one. Like, look, he slipped one white gloved hand from beneath his scarlet woolen cloak. Okay, he's got gloves on too. That's cool.
Just scarlet woolen
cloak. Oh yeah, red cloak. Okay, he's got. That's cool. Can I get the Morgan Kell?
The Morgan Kell fit
cloak. The Kellhound's cloak. That's pretty good. Listen, of course, this is where Morgan pulls out that piece of paper, right? Says, I
that
have
piece
this.
Of paper.
Yeah.
It's not just any old piece of paper, even though it does look upon agent, first examination.
He just holds it out. Aha, don't worry. And the dude snatches it from him. He's like, this better be good, old man.
I have a permit for this.
Yeah.
I went through him. He tells him, he's like, this better be good or I'm going to throw you in jail. That's what he says. He's like, you're going to go to jail.
I'm up to here with you, dude.
Yeah. like you are moments away from getting arrested, sir.
He's lucky. He's actually, if anyone who's ever worked security, Morgan's lucky that he didn't just get tackled.
Yeah.
Like, he's already made everyone super uncomfortable.
It's very funny. So dude takes the paper from him, pops it open, looks down at it. Looks back up at Morgan, like quizzically, and like looks back down. He seems visibly shaken by what he sees. He hands the paper back to Morgan and he tells him, prove it. And Dan doesn't know what's going on, just like us. We're with him, right? We're just watching this happen.
This man confidently walked through palace security.
Yeah.
And then hand him a piece of paper.
A rustic, kind of yellowed piece of paper.
So Morgan, this is where he puts his thumbprint on the paper, right? The holographic verification. He does. There's like a place. There's like this holographic, unforgeable, holographic signature thumbprint thing.
This is a verigraph. There's actually like a thin microchip embedded into the document itself. It scans the DNA of the individual using it. In this case, Morgan Kell, to help verify that Morgan Kell is indeed Morgan Kell.
And it's like unforgeable, right? This is accepted by heads of state. Oh, you know where we saw this? Wait a minute. Simon Johnson mentioned this in the first book, I think, when we first see him and Katrina, and they're talking about the body double candidates, and he's received that memo about he got that report about what happened with Hans and the body double. And I think that, yeah, because it has the Varagraph on it. Okay. This is a thing. Yeah. I think it said that. Listen, it's verified. Basically is what I'm saying. The dude snatches the paper back and looks at it and he sees that the thumbprint matches. So Dan's watching all this. He doesn't know what's going on, but immediately the dude's behavior changes
drastically,
right? I think Dan can see, it looks like his hand is like shaking. Yes. This man suddenly becomes very anxious.
The agent looks horrified. I'm sorry, sir. I have to call this in.
Yeah. He tells Morgan that he's got to call in. And Morgan's like, no, you don't got to call it in. I feel like he just puts his like hand on his shoulder. Like, no, buddy. No,
I don't think you do.
You don't got it. He's like, oh,
it's some real like finger on lips, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Don't worry about it. He's like, okay, I don't got to call it in. It's fine.
I guess not. Like, I think this is the closest we're going to get to a Jedi mind trick.
Go in. Yeah. He sends them on their way. Exactly. It has huge Jedi mind trick energy. These two go on my clearance. It's so funny. And he sends them on their way. Morgan's like, thanks. And they just start walking. Dan's like, oh, okay. And they just like, Morgan's like, come on, let's go. He's playing it so cool. He's so cool.
Let's not dilly-daddle.
We got places to be.
Yeah. The guard's mouth is on the ground. Dan's mouth is on the ground.
Yeah. You got to, like, what movies did Stackpole watch around this time? This is, you get it. Right away, you're like, oh, Morgan Kell. He's just a Giga Chad. He's just the coolest dude. And he's like, yeah, I'm back. And I got a sick outfit. So they keep walking. And Dan wants to know what's in that note, though. He's like, hey, what's up with that paper? You know, yeah, can I see that?
As one would, right? Yeah. Like, yeah, I'm like, I kind of want to know. What was that all about?
Yeah. You know, I feel like they're just walking. Morgan's like, it's chill. And he's like, bro, that was crazy. That was wild, dude. He's like, it would have been harder if we had brought our mechs, right? It was literally easier than like fighting our way in with mechs. And I'm like, that's true. They would put up a harder fight. So Morgan gives Dan the note. And of course, this is where we see that the note reads, deny this man, Morgan Kell, nothing. Katrina Steiner, Archon, 22nd of July, 3007, right? Deny him nothing. It's literally the blankest of checks, right?
And Morgan calls it in for a party invite.
For an invite. Yeah. He's like, I'm gonna pull up. It's so sick. It says deny him nothing. He's got a note from the Archon. Deny this man nothing. He's had it the whole time. Since 3007.
Since 3007.
It's 20 years ago.
20 years.
He's really lucky that chip technology in the future got a lot better, that this thing still worked after 20 years, because it could have been real awkward if he goes to scan it in and it has like a scan failure.
Oh, no.
Especially since it literally looks like he's been keeping it in his loincloth at the monastery.
Yeah, it doesn't smell good.
So they walk up to the Archon's palace, right? They get in the party. They walk to the front doors. Servants take their coats. And we get this whole scene where the boys like check their fits. We get to see what they're wearing. First, we see that Dan is wearing his spurs. And he's very proud of them. I don't know if we talked about this before. About how the mech warriors from the Federated Sons wear the spurs that recall their cavalry beginnings. He's very proud of them. And he's got red dress jacket, white gloves, waist length coat. He's got that jacket, right? It's cut in the crest. That's what it says. Like the fabric is kind of cut into the on the breast to form the crest of the Kellhounds, right? It comes to that point with like the eyes. Yeah. He's got the Dragon Slayer's ribbon. He's got this cool uniform. It's like black and red. He looks great.
It feels a little bit more stylish than a lot of the Great House uniforms you see. And it seems exactly what you would expect from like a premier mercenary force, right? These guys were and are a big deal as far as mercenaries go.
His rank insignia is a silver V with the black triangle above, and he's a captain. Well, he's irritated because he's in Lyran space, so he knows he'll have to stomach an entire evening of being called Hauptmann. He's like, they call me Hauptmann here. That sucks. And you know
Captain's
what?
Captain's so much easier.
Captain is better. I think so. I'm with him.
It is a mouthful of consonants.
Dan looks over at Morgan, and Morgan is wearing his, I think it's the same old uniform, right? He pulls one of the old ones out. Still fits, though, right? Dan looks over. He's like, looks good. Still fits. Morgan's like, a little tight in the shoulders. It's good. It's all right. They look good. I just like this scene where they're just like, it just kind of luxuriates for a while. Like they're just like in their sick outfits, like standing in front of these mirrors. They're in line, right, to get in the grand ballroom. They're lined up outside. You guys see this part? I like where they're like looking at this art, and Morgan is able to identify the artist, Katir, but it's funny. Morgan thinks Katir never changed her style. He's like, wow, she's still doing the same stuff from 12 years ago or whatever. But Dan tells him, oh, well, that's just a throwback, right? It's, it's just come back around. You've been gone so long.
That we're in the revisionist movement.
Yeah.
You know, she's in her revisionist stage.
Came back. It basically is what, and Morgan's like, dang.
I also like the little insight. What did we get before? The Rimworld's neo...
realist, wasn't it?
Neo-realist, yeah. I think you're right. Yeah, Rimworld's neo-realist.
There are some cool artist characters. Shout out to Sven Newmark, right? I like that guy. So this is where they're standing in line, and a little man comes up and asks Morgan how they wish to be addressed, right? What's your title? You know, because everyone here is probably some noble of some such. And Morgan tells the guy that he wants all ranks and honors. Now, the guy tells him, no way. We're not doing that. That takes so long. We're trying to, you know, in the interest of brevity, sir, that we're not really, don't make me do, that's that's insane, right? He can't believe it.
Yeah.
He's like, he guffaws. So Morgan, of course, pulls out the note.
Oh, right? God.
Yeah.
Yep.
He just stands just watching, and he knows it's coming. He's like, pulls out the note. Dude looks down.
Oh, boy.
Head's already shaking back and forth.
As you say, sir, all ranks and honors. So they're standing atop the steps, crystal chandeliers, lots of food. It's very nice. It's this beautiful, it says there's food from all over the Lyran Commonwealth, tables lining the walls, beautiful ballroom. Ivory colored walls, gold leaf trim around the doors and molding. It's beautiful. We got musicians. So they're all waiting in this line to get introduced. Dan goes first. The minister of protocol, right?
The minister of protocol.
Yeah. The mop, we call him.
Man, if there's a job that I never, ever want to have in any lifetime, it's the minister of protocol. The mop. Oh my God, you guys.
Yeah. I'll take the job.
I think I'd make a pretty good mop.
Yeah. Mop them up.
That's like my nightmare.
Mop them. Listen. So the minister introduces Dan. I present Lord Daniel Allard, Hauptmann of the Kellhounds.
There it is.
Yeah. Gives him the Hauptmann. And I love this. You see, he starts going down the stairs and the camera like pans over and you see Melissa like glance up. She hears it and looks up. But then, like, she gets obscured by the, like, crowd again. And Dan, like, loses sight of her. It's very cinematic. And so Dan goes down the stairs so that he can watch Morgan's entrance. And he looks up and he sees Morgan. Morgan's just standing at the top. Power stance. Right. Basically, yeah. That's what he says.
Oh, yeah. Ball fist on hips.
Yeah.
Yeah. Leg spread.
The ultimate power stance. He's got the silver medal. War between his collar and the wolf's heads, two ribbons, just the way he stands there. Those ribbons and medals mean nothing. He's got more power in his stance than most men could find in a mech regiment. Power stancing, dude. Boom. He's displaying his aura is so strong.
The scouter's like going off. It's like, we don't have enough numbers, bud.
Yeah, we're definitely over 9,000 territory.
There it is.
I couldn't leave you out there.
Dan sees Morgan up there. And the minister's up there next to him. It's Morgan's turn. He sees the minister is holding the card and his fingers are trembling. And so, yeah, the minister gets tripped up for a second. So there's kind of a break in the introductions. And so we even see people start to turn. People kind of like start to look up there, like who's coming next, and they see the
because
minister.
There's been a stream, right? Yeah. There's just been a stream of guys getting like, and next up, it's so and so from so and where.
Then there was a pause, and people were like, and then they just look up there, and it's who's that guy in that powerful stance up there?
He's like silhouetted a little bit by the lights.
Yeah, I present Baron von Arkroyal, member of the Order of the Tamar Tigers. Knight Defender of the Draconis March, Regimental Holder of the Order of St. George, Colonel Morgan Kell of the Kellhounds. And there's just silence for a moment. The dancers stop dancing, right? The musicians like stop playing. Everyone like stops talking and like looks up at him. And Morgan, he just starts, he's like just nods and he starts walking down the stairs, right? He walks down to Dan. Yeah, you can hear his footsteps echoing, right? As he walks down the marble, like you can hear his boots on the tile.
His swagger has swagger.
He hooks up with Dan. Everyone starts talking immediately. You hear everyone starts course, you know. Yeah. Mallory's world.
Is that really him? Morgan, is this some kind of joke?
And so they come down the stairs and Katrina comes over, right? She's talking to someone and you get a shot of her being like, hold on one second. Right. And kind of like starts
like
darting over through the
through
crowd,
the crowd.
Like cutting the Archon. Yeah. And like Melissa's with her. They cut over to him. And Katrina goes up to Morgan, extends her hand. She says, seeing you again, Colonel, gives me more pleasure than you could even know. And Morgan takes her hand in both of his and tells her, I think you're wrong, Archon, because seeing you gives me equal pleasure. And they share a big hug. And it's nice. Morgan holding her tightly. He says, damn it, Katrina, it's been too long. Katrina tells Morgan she was so sorry to hear about Patrick. And Morgan thanks her. He does declare that he knows that Patrick made the sacrifice. Gladly, he says. And this is where Melissa approaches. She's in a silver gown with a cape. She's got this cool cape. And Morgan lunges forward and sweeps her up in a hug.
Ah!
People start looking around. Right. When he runs forward and grabs Melissa Steiner, there is an exchange of concerned glances. Right. But then it says Melissa shrieks in delight. Everyone's like, oh, okay. I guess is that cool?
I guess it's cool.
It's cool. All right.
We're good here, I guess. All right.
Yeah. Morgan sets her down and he tells her, the last time I saw you, you were all braids, black and blue. And apparently, you know, it's some shared memory they have. It reminds her of Patrick. And she tells Morgan that she is so sorry. And this is, Morgan, though, he leans in and he whispers something in her ear. And Dan, I feel like we see all this from Dan, though. He's like kind of standing a little away from them. And he sees Morgan lean down, whisper something. And Melissa's just like nodding and sniffing, like, you know, for a while. Morgan stands back up. And yeah, Morgan introduces Dan, Captain Daniel Allard. The Archon shakes his hand and she calls him Captain. I wanted to point out, she says Captain. I'm honored as well, Captain. You know, she knows about Dan. Oh, I like when they shake hands. It does say, Dan notes she has a firm grip, right? I mean, we already knew this, but there's confirmation. Katrina has a vice-like handshake, a firm grip, a mech warrior's grip, Dan says.
Which,
she's scary.
As we learned from the first book, she is indeed a mech warrior.
Yeah. Katrina thanks Dan for his role in the rescue of the Silver Eagle. And she asks about his shoulder. Remember he got injured? Remember when he was strapped to that chair and it slammed him into the wall?
Yeah.
And
the rocket chair fiasco.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. He tried spinning and it was not a very good trick.
He says he's doing good. He's fully recovered. And this is where he turns to Melissa, right? Because he goes to greet Melissa Steiner and he remembers, but she was never there, right? The official story is she's not, so technically they've never met before, right? He makes sure to make a show of like having that this is their first meeting. Oh, it's a great pleasure to meet you, finally. You're not at all the little girl that Morgan described. And he's doing a whole bit. He's like, well, Melissa Steiner, I have never seen you before. She thinks it's so funny. She gives his fingers a little squeeze.
I'm sure it is. Knowing Dan, it's probably not the best showing, right?
He puts his hands out and she puts her hand. She gives his fingers a little squeeze. Oh, I like it says, as befitting a lady of good breeding.
Which is a weird thing to say.
Shout out to breathing.
We can forgive Dan for being off of his A game here. He's gone through a lot just getting into the party. So,
yeah, Dan's definitely on the back foot through all of this. At least that's the way I see it in my head.
I like this part where Melissa claims that had she known the Kellhounds officers were so handsome and men of such wit, she would have asked her mother to post them here on Tharkad long ago, right? Why weren't they here?
I love the response that Katrina rings back, which is for the sake of those here on the Silver Eagle. Thank God the Kellhound secret was well kept.
Yeah, exactly. She's saying, had you known the Kellhound's officers were so charming, then they wouldn't have been there to save the Silver Eagle, huh? And
we get a sweet mock pout out of Melissa then. If it was up to you, Mother, I'd have no fun at all.
Yeah, she makes a pouty face. And exactly, I'd have no fun at all. However, she's sure that Colonel Kell would welcome a posting on Tharkad. What do you say, right? I mean, maybe, you know, maybe, She's like fishing here. You know, I'm sure she'd, you know, what are you saying? I love this. Morgan apologizes because he'd never allow the hounds to be posted on Tharkad. What? Why? And I love this man.
With a wink.
Yes, it's incredible. He looks over and gives Dan a little wink right before declaring that, you see, I'd never give my men such hazardous duty.
The chapter then ends in my imagination with them all laughing in semi-unison.
I love it, yeah. The wink. He knows what he's doing. What a devil, right?
Well, this chapter as a whole shows he knows what he's doing.
We've never seen his old skin, but it's clear he slipped back into it.
Yeah, Stackpole really does a great job of showing us, like, who was Morkan Kell? It's this guy.
It turns out he's got that dog in him.
Yeah, that hound.
No, I really enjoyed this chapter. I don't think I've said it on the podcast before, but one of my all-time favorite books is The Count of Monte Cristo. And this chapter radiates The Count of Monte Cristo energy.
Yes, totally. Yeah, you're right. It does. He's back. But yeah, totally. And he does have that like roguish charm, right? You get it right away. You're like, what's Morgan Kell all about? But you already knew. You know, Patrick had that. I feel like Patrick was more of the kind of like dark bad boy kind of, you know, I feel like
having a good time.
I feel like he probably wore more black. You know what I mean?
Right.
Right, with Patrick. And Morgan was the more, you know, he's here to swashbuckle. Look at this guy.
He was
he's
the
like
negotiator.
A pirate captain situation going on, right? He's a Chad.
Well, and I think this chapter says a lot about Morgan putting his plan into action. He picked the place where he'd get the most impact from the largest amount of people to announce his return. He played a role perfectly here. He seemed completely in command of all the events that led up to this and the execution of it.
It goes so hard in the beginning, dude, when he pulls the note out on him. Yeah. They're like walking to the streets. It's cool. A lot happens here, actually. And of course, yeah, man, the intro scene where he's like, what do I read the titles? Everyone turns because he's got like a very good beard, right? I'm thinking very full, healthy, good. I feel, you know, he's got like long hair. He's got the beard. It's Morgan Kell. He's back. We did it. He's back. He's on Tharkad. It's New Year's Eve and he's here to meet the Archon.
This whole chapter, it's very clear that the principle here is simply let's make Morgan Kell cool. Let's make him likable, right?
Yeah.
Because
up
until now, you might have been on the fence, especially with Dan ragging on him. But what do you think for you guys, if you had to name one thing in particular about this scene that really endears you to Morgan, what do you think? What is it?
Oh, the most endearing? I mean, I love at the end when he winks at Dan. Come on, the whole, let me shout it out again. This little joke we end with, how do we close this thing out, right? And we get this little, I'm sorry, Mel, I'd never allow the Kellhounds to be posted on Tharkad. Winks at Dan, finger guns, boom, you know, like, I'd never give my men such hazardous duty. boom, we're out. End of chapter. He's entertaining himself, dragging Dan around. He thinks this is hilarious.
The ragging on Dan was very endearing for Morgan. For me, I think overall as the whole, it was the strategy of it all. Morgan isn't this guy right now.
Yeah.
But he knows exactly the act to put on because this would be the thing everybody passes along. This is going to be something that reaches Yorinaga. And he executes that of complete confidence.
You mean like he's going to be in the papers type of a thing?
Yeah.
He'll be on the internet.
It's a show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a carefully planned show.
For me, the sum of all those things, right? The swagger, the just coming in with cunning and confidence. And it's clear that he's planned all this out, but he's pretending that he hasn't. But he's acting like he hasn't planned it all out, right? But for me, this is the thing that in this scene endears Morgan to me most. And it's when he whispers into Melissa's ear.
And you
can tell, like, for me, that's the moment where all that other stuff was like, oh, like, look at this guy, you know, whatever. And I like that Stackpole leaves it up to interpretation. It's always really going to be better what you think it is, what, you know, instead of what he says. Well, you know, sometimes it is. But it's clear whatever it is that he says to her, it's to help ease her pain that she feels around Patrick sacrificing his life for her.
Yeah.
To me, I find that the most endearing, that even though he's putting on this whole dog and pony show, he's going all out, big ego, big pants, big suit, big cloak. He like takes the time mid party to be like, I know I'm probably, you know, seeing me is bringing up all these feelings. Let me take a moment and make you feel a little bit better.
Yeah. For me, that was a big part, that this is almost like a battle tactic for him.
Yes.
But he does not lose his sentimentality in the moment.
Exactly.
A true warrior. The mindset. Also, their uniforms are sick, though. Like, we haven't seen a fit this hard since Duke Recall. You know what I mean?
It's true.
Yeah. He comes in with the, and similar too, both red, right? Projecting power. The red and the black. It's cool that the Kellhounds are red and black. Good color scheme.
It's a beloved color scheme in the Inner Sphere, as we will undoubtedly uncover as we cover even more books.
To me, this chapter also holds that thing I've come to love in these Stackpole books is like when Stackpole makes a big splash chapter, you know that the repercussions and the ripples that it reaches from here are going to be wild.
Yeah.
And so now it's like every time I read one of these, I'm like, oh man, I can't wait to see what Stackpole's got cooking.
That's what's exciting. You're right. That's what, because you know that it's all set up, right?
Yeah.
Stackpole will make sure that this pays off.
Yeah. Because if it wasn't, it would have cut to a meeting in the Archon's office.
Exactly.
Also, shout out to Doc Shootenloot, who said this was his favorite chapter.
Yeah. And what's cool is we're not even done, right? I mean, this is, it's New Year's Eve, dude. Like, we just got to the party. Now we're in it. Deep behind enemy lines, right? But we made it. They got in. They met with the Archon. This is chill, but also, I like how fast this has all happened, right? How long was this chapter from start to finish? Think about all that's happened to Dan so quickly. This is like, what is it? Has it been like 10 minutes? Depending on how long did they wait in line? I don't know if it says, but...
Yeah.
Well, okay, did they just... I think at some point they did, when they were doing the honors, they did wait their turn for honors, yeah.
You're correct, yeah.
Yeah, so much has happened so fast. We're just getting started. It's a party. New Year's Eve, you know what I'm saying? Darkhead, 27.
Fine vintage.
And with the grand introduction over with, we'll have to see how the party keeps going in the next chapter.
Chapter 14. So this one starts with Katrina, right? They're all hanging out there by the stairs, but it doesn't take long. This is like a big party, right? Immediately, this one starts with, it says, Katrina sees the jackals closing in, right? Various individuals moving in directions, she's like, oh, you know, we got to move. You know, we're on a cooldown. She can't, like, stand in one place for too long, right? She gets bogged down. So she grabs Morgan and she says she needs some air. You want to get out of here? Come on. And of course, he's chill with it. He says, a pleasurable duty and an honor. The minister, however, is very upset. Remember the minister of protocol?
Yeah, the mop. We love him.
Right, because this is a breach of protocol. Right, because she's also here to greet everyone. Everyone's supposed to get a meet and greet with the Archon. Right, it said that on the invitation. He's very upset. She's supposed to stay and greet the guests. She feels bad. She does. She's like, I'm so sorry. I know that this is like your whole life. I know that I'm like ruining your life. But Katrina's like, I'm sorry, but I'm leaving. And then Melissa does the same thing. Well, she grabs Dan, right? And Melissa's like, oh, I think I'll go dancing. And what's he going to do, though? She's literally the Archon, right? That's the problem. He's like, but you can't. She's like, but I'm the Archon. And he's like, she's right. She's the Archon, so.
What are you going to do about it?
Yeah, she had to do it to him.
And she did.
I like this bit where Katrina watches Melissa jaunt off with Dan in tow. And she thinks to herself, I hope that Hans Davian realizes what he's got himself into. Oh, yes, watched her daughter indulgently. Listen, so they spin up the band. The minister goes running off, and Katrina takes Morgan. They dip out the side door. She takes Morgan to her office, right? I feel like we now, as the viewer, follow them down this corridor to Katrina's office. Morgan comes in. He's looking around, and she's still got the desk. Like, oh, you still got that old thing, huh? I love this. When he comes in, Morgan is pleased to see that she still has that same old desk that she has from all those years ago. And she says that she can't part with it because Arthur made it with his own hands, her late husband, right? Apparently, he built this desk for her. She can't get rid of it. Arthur built this. And this is where Morgan cuts in and tells him, well, you know, he had a little help with it. You know what I mean? Implying that he assisted. However, Katrina says that Arthur told her that he just supervised. And Morgan affects a pose of offended nobility. No. And he points to a drawer and he says, what about that drawer? I did that drawer. And she's like, oh, that drawer? Yeah, that one. The one on the right? And he's like, yeah. And she's like, the one that sticks? And he says, I told Arthur he had the casing all wrong. And he's like, damn, those were the days. Katrina asks Morgan if he still drinks Irish whiskey. But Morgan says, I don't know. He's been in St. Marinus' house. It's dry. 11 years dry, bone dry. I like he mentions your uncle, Brother Giles, runs a tight ship. Wasn't that? That was that Steiner guy.
The one that, you know, we first met him as he entered the monastery.
So Katrina pulls out this bottle. It's a nice, I like, she says it's from the Connor Distillery on Ark Royal. Patrick had them send me a case each year. She's got this, like, you know, top shelf Irish whiskey. She pours him some whiskey. They have a drink. And this is where she asks Morgan, why didn't you ever tell me that Arthur was a member of Heimdall? She gets right to it. You can tell, oh, she's been wanting to ask this for a while. This is the first thing. She brings him into her office. Oh, yeah, nice desk. You want a drink? You know?
Yeah.
Okay. So why didn't you tell me Arthur was a member of Heimdall?
She's been working up to it the whole time.
What's going on?
Yeah.
So now we get this explanation. Why didn't Morgan Kell tell Katrina that Arthur was a member of Heimdall? Well.
Why indeed?
For one, he says, well, Arthur didn't tell you. Maybe he was trying to keep it separate. Maybe also Heimdall, it's the opposition party. We act as a counterbalance. It's a fraternal organization, right? Arthur's father inducted him, okay? And then Patrick brought us all in.
Which I thought was an interesting little statement there, that he mentions both him and Patrick were also involved in Heimdall.
Yeah.
Through their cousin Arthur.
Arthur, exactly. I like this. He's going on. He gives this very long explanation. It's like he has this whole speech. Arthur didn't want that. As much as he loved and trusted you, he did not want to compromise the organization. If you had asked, he would have brought Heimdall to the mainstream, but it would not have been there when we needed.
He hits her with, it's a secret, and that's its boon, right?
Right.
The thing that it does is it's a secret, and that's its power. That's what it has.
Yeah, it's Heimdall. And he didn't tell you. He would have told you. Does that make sense? Yeah. And I like Katrina. I just feel like she's just been looking at him. She's just like, okay. She says, yes, that does explain why Arthur didn't tell me about his ties with Heimdall. But that does not explain whatsoever why you said nothing after his death. She's right. She's like, what? That's not my question. And this is where he just looks down and says, so I made a mistake. He should have done it. He realizes he should have told her. He didn't tell her, but he should have.
He also adds in that because Arthur didn't tell her, that seemed to be the reflection of his wish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He ends the statement with saying, I didn't say anything because I didn't want you to think less of us.
Yeah. Didn't want you to think less of us.
Which I also thought this conversation that Katrina throws Morgan into almost right away kind of ambushes him with it a little bit to get to the true Morgan.
Yeah.
It's 100% an ambush, right? She softens him up. And when he's feeling a little loose, you know, a little confident from the whole drawer thing, well, confident maybe on the back foot a little bit even.
He squirmed too. She made Morgan Kell squirm. Katrina Steiner.
Right.
The goat.
But I also think it gives us our first look at the real Morgan in this evening.
Isn't this a stark contrast from literally a scene ago?
Yeah.
Where he strode in.
A man in full command.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There was no way the Morgan of 10 minutes ago would have admitted a mistake.
It's literally like the Chad virgin meme, but they're both Morgan.
Yeah.
But yeah, he didn't tell her. And he admits now that he should have. He's sorry. It was a mistake. I like this. This is where Katrina, she walks over. She picks up that like hollow cube, right? She's got this cool little display unit. It's like you peer into it. I think it said it's this cube.
You've got to ponder the hollow cube.
Yeah, within it contains this three-dimensional. Yeah, she ponders this cube. It's a picture from 20 years ago. It's Katrina, her husband, Arthur, and a much younger Morgan Kell on the left, wearing a blue shirt open to mid-chest to reveal a heavy thatch of black hair. All right?
Our second chest hair scene.
Thin mustache curled up at the ends. Okay? This is some real... They're swashbucklers.
Yeah.
Right?
Some musketeer vibes here.
This looks... It looks like the... It's just... It's like the cover of a romance novel. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's what...
From like the 90s.
Straight up.
It's kind of like the book cover of this fantasy novel I read once. Once a Hero by Michael A. Stackpole.
Once a Hero. Is that good?
Well, I may have fibbed. I haven't finished reading it, but...
Just another book on the Stackpole Shrine?
It says that in the hologram, Katrina's hair is dyed a bright red, right? Note this. Red hair. Also, Arthur has a black headband and a mustache and a goatee. He's got a roguish
heck
look.
Yeah.
The whole band is, they're very roguish. Devil may care attitude. You know what I'm saying?
If you're ever looking in the mirror and asking yourself if you can rock a headband, the answer is yes. Yeah. Do it, King. Do it.
It doesn't say anything about earrings, but you know at least one of these guys has like the single earring.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, for sure.
At least that's how I see it.
One's got the earring, one's got the waist sash.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. And she holds the cube out to Morgan, and he picks it up. He looks into it, and he says, God, the Red Corsair and her two henchmen. Yeah, I think they've mentioned this before. The Red Corsair, right? You start to get this idea that they used to go out and have swashbuckling adventures across the stars.
Katrina's the Red Corsair.
Yeah.
Is what we learn here.
Yeah.
It's kind of a bit of a, if you didn't already know, it is a bit of a like drop here.
She's Katrina's the Red Corsair. Yeah.
The aforementioned Red Corsair.
The original Red Corsair. They got up to some pretty wild stuff. And I'm sure at the time it was pretty scary, but they can reminisce now safely. And be like, oh, you know what? We had a good time. We had some fun adventures, huh? You just get the scene where they're just kind of thinking about, apparently they used to go doing scoundrel stuff. That's cool. I want to know more about that. Oh, I like this bit where Morgan tells Katrina that one of the brothers at St. Marinus was actually from a band of periphery raiders. And he said they're still looking for the Red Corsair to this day. than periphery raiders out there. So they were out in the periphery. What were they doing out there?
Causing trouble, it seems.
Causing trouble, exactly. Having adventures, hijinks, getting into trouble and whatnot.
So there's actually a short story, believe it or not, about the Red Corsair that Michael Stackpole wrote himself in 2009. It was exclusively in the limited edition version of A Time of War. And as far as my research has gathered, there's no way to access this story anymore.
It was never scanned.
Right, and it was exclusively in this limited edition printing of the rules-heavy version of the BattleTech RPG, A Time of War. So if you do have that, that's awesome. You can read in there the short story. You can get some insight into what Katrina Steiner was up to in 3004.
Apparently. This is a potential preservation effort, right?
Right.
If there's no scans for them, there should be scans.
It would be great. I know that these are in a these were kind of like part of a sale for a limited edition printing, but
we got a little bit. We've got a scarcity situation going on here.
And
God, it's occulted knowledge.
And that's all fine and good, right? But if anyone from Catalyst is listening, it would be really great to be able to some way to pay and have access to some of these stories. This is an all too common occurrence, sadly, of these kind of like stories that are literally lost in time in old printings and stuff, and they just kind of drift off into the sunset, only to be remembered in a Sarna article somewhere.
That's so interesting. Yeah. And again, please, if anyone knows anything, advice@heat.management. Shout it out. Vanished by Stackpole. The Time of War Limited Edition. Okay, now we're on to something. All right. Very exciting. Okay, listen. I wanted to talk about this line where Katrina reached out and gave his shoulders a squeeze. You miss her as much as I miss Arthur, don't you? Tempest? His head came up and he forced a weak smile. Perhaps, had things not ended so abruptly, my answer would be yes. As it is, I just don't know. Oh, and Katrina says she's sorry she brought it up. He mentions Tempest here. And so, I wasn't sure what this whole Tempest thing was about, honestly. So, naturally, I did a little reading. And I discovered that in Mercenaries Handbook 3055, page 63, we learn that in 3034, a woman, Megan Kell, gets married. And that's Morgan's daughter from a liaison in his youth. And that woman, Megan, she has children, and she names one of them Tempest. I think that this is, to what I could find, the closest thing to like a direct reference to this in like a source book. I think there's some other murmurings. Listen, so Tempest, it's clearly like a former lover of his, right? There's a story there. I don't know if it's ever been told exactly, if he meant to revisit this or has it, and I just can't find it, just in terms of more information. But, you know, obviously, we've learned that, you know, this is a woman from his youth. And, well, just like the Red Corsair situation, she's from the before times, right? The old days, the bad days, the all or nothing days. There's a story there. I just wanted to point that out. Now, I do like this bit where Morgan here, looking down on this previous version of himself, turns to Katrina and asks, do you think I should go back to just a mustache? Do you think I should go back to just a mustache?
Katrina is quick to shake her head and say, no. The full beard. Yeah,
keep the beard.
It's good. More becoming. No. It's the exact language she uses.
It's more becoming. Oh, I love how she says, however, if Comstar decides to hold a masquerade as part of Melissa's wedding celebration, perhaps we can reprise the Red Corsair in some of her court. And I like, she's kind of frisky here. She's like, she's like, wouldn't it be fun to dress up again? To dress up in the costumes, wouldn't that be cool? It's charming.
It's fun seeing these characters reminisce of adventures past.
Yeah. This is where Morgan remembers that he totally forgot. He forgot to congratulate Melissa on her engagement and all that. He says, oh, I'm such a dummy. I totally forgot to congratulate her. But Katrina tells him that actually, she's probably pretty thankful that you didn't mention it, right? She's tired of everyone's mentioning it. Everyone's fishing for invitations. Wow, that'll be so nice. Wish I could be there. Yeah, she's sick of it. So it was actually probably, you actually made a great call. Good job. Now, Morgan says something pretty interesting here. He says that they heard about the engagement on Zaniah. When the news came out, Brother Giles and I were both worried that this might become a rallying point for dissidents and rivals in the Commonwealth. Everyone keeps saying this. Yeah. Come on, guys, chill out. It's fine. Everyone keeps saying that.
You guys know that old Isle of Skye.
Now, listen. Brother Giles even had a visitor from Solaris and Enrico Lestrade, who inquired if he wanted to come out of retirement in light of the engagement. So Enrico Lestrade himself came to Zaniah. Yeah, outrageous. Enrico Lestrade himself came all the way to Zaniah, I'm assuming trying to get Herman Steiner, now Brother Giles, right? The brother previously known as Herman. But he turned him down. Enrico, remember this guy? This was like the, I feel like this was like the kind of party animal fail son from Warrior on Guard. You needed to dry out. Good, take a little trip. It'll be good for you. This is news to Katrina, who informs Morgan that there has been some light resistance among the nobility. We got the usual suspects, right? Aldo Lestrade, Frederick Steiner, you know what I mean? She says, Aldo's engineered at least 2 failed assassination attempts against me, and I think he was behind the Silver Eagle's diversion. She says, the hard evidence may be tantalizingly elusive, but I know he's the author of many of my troubles. Yeah, I mean, she's right. The Lyran Court thing, remember Frederick Steiner? Oh, yeah. Katrina knows, though, this guy, Aldo Lestrade, is apparently, I don't think he's very good at this. He messed up, basically. I mean, look what he did. We got Morgan Kell standing in the Archon's office, all right? This is because of what Lestrade did. She realizes here, she thinks to herself, Lestrade killed Patrick Kell. Morgan and Heimdall, they're not going to forget that, right? You literally, you have upset Morgan Kell and Heimdall. She realizes, oh, he messed up though, right? That's a good point. She, she drew this connection here where she's like, don't forget that Lestrade is culpable here. He directly set in motion the events that led to Patrick's death. Was it fated? Was it destiny? Was it just coincidence? Who can say?
Smells like Commissar to me.
And when she went over that, I did have a moment where I wondered, was that Katrina speaking or was it the Archon? Because by mentioning that, it definitely points Morgan in a direction.
Yeah.
And it just so happens to be at her opposition.
I think, I'm going to be honest with you, I don't think there's a clear answer to that. I think it's a little of both.
Yeah.
I think this is both the machination of state and heart.
Good point. Oh, man, this is where we get the scene where Morgan tells Katrina that he needs to ask a favor of her because he says that Dan told him about that clause in their contract where the whole time while Patrick was operating the Kellhounds, there was a clause where if Morgan returned, he had total control. He could cancel any contracts or whatever. And that's a clause in every contract that they've signed and whatnot. It's that whole thing. Basically, the Kellhounds are currently in the employ of the Lyran Commonwealth, right? They're under Katrina's employ, but he needs a favor because he needs control of the Hounds now. He has some things he needs to do, right?
Unfinished business.
He tells her, Yorinaga has returned. Yeah, it's true. Morgan looked up and sighed heavily. Believe me, Katrina, when I tell you Yorinaga's return to duty, it's palpable. I knew he was back months before Dan came to Zaniah. Drawn together, mystical energies and whatnot. He does mention here again what happened in 3013. Because remember, that one Mallory's World story, right? The one where they dueled and he bowed and he threw the swords. That was actually their second meeting on Mallory's World. Morgan Kell and Yorinaga Kurita had met on Mallory's World, I believe, 3 years earlier in 3013 when, well, when tattered remnants of the Davian Fourth Guards and two companies of the Kellhounds held off the Second Sword of Light while other Davian troops evacuated Ian Davian and pried his body out of his broken mech.
Ian Davian, at the time, being the first prince or leader of House Davian.
He was the first prince, and him and Morgan were good friends. It says, Yorinaga had killed Ian, but we prevented him from taking home any trophy. Okay? So, Ian and Yorinaga got in a duel. Or I'm not sure. This story gets, you get more detail on this somewhere else. I know I've read about this fight. Anyway, you know, Yorinaga wanted to claim the trophy, right? Battlefield salvage. And the body of the prince, or the, you know, the body or the capture of Ian Davian would have been an incredible prize, but the Kellhounds showed up. Morgan showed up and chased them off. And so Yorinaga wasn't able to claim his prize. He was dishonored, right? That's why when they returned to Mallory's world later, they already had, there was already a situation. And then all that other stuff happened. So he tells her about, we went back to Mallory's world. We had that fight. You've read the book. Heavily fictionalized, right? But he tells her, he's explaining, it's good. This has to sound so crazy. He's like, listen, look.
It's an inevitability.
It's like Katrina's standing there watching him, and Morgan Kell is like, I fear what I learned, to be honest, and I felt the seeds of the same terrible thing in Yorinaga. While both of us remained in exile, nothing could happen. Now we'll be drawn together, inexorably, and our fight must eventually take place. There's no other way. She says, well, so do you think I could convince you to wait till, after the wedding, before you head off on this little quest of yours? He agrees. He says, yes, we can wait.
Looking at it from her perspective, it does feel a little dramatic, right? Yeah. It does seem like, but we know otherwise.
Did he rehearse this?
This feels like a real, like, turn away, fist clutch moment.
Yeah. Morgan tells her he's got to pull the Kellhounds from active duty. Says that they're already on their way to Ark Royal. Right? Ark Royal? That's like the Kellhounds planet. They're always hanging out on Ark Royal. Well, I think the Kell family is a baron. You know, that's their landholding, I believe. What do I look like? A lore guy?
You are correct. In fact, Morgan, I believe, is the baron of Ark Royal.
Baron von Ark Royal.
As we just learned previously.
He's literally the baron of Ark Royal. So, yeah. That's his, you know, ancestral holdings. He's a landed gentry, a fine gentleman. And now Katrina does, reasonably, ask him, so do you think it's a good idea to have, like, a light battalion going up against what's, you know, what's likely to be, you know, an entire Karita regiment? Morgan says, no, not at all. Smiling, he raised his glass in a salute. That's why the word went out from Zanaya. The Kellhound unit I'm assembling at Ark Royal will be, once again, a full regiment. Let the dragon beware. And that's it. That's the end of the chapter. I like the idea of Katrina hanging out with Morgan. She's like, oh man, he's been kind of goblinized. We've got some light, you know, goblinization going on. He's funny. This is great, though. I love this scene, by the way. I was excited to talk about this. Where it's just like this hangout scene with Morgan and Katrina.
It's two buds catching up, but also it's a head of state and the leader of one of the premier mercenary companies under our employ also having a meeting simultaneously.
Yeah, it's so good. I love the bit about the desk where, like, the drawer sticks.
Yes.
I always remember that. That was one of my favorite jokes where it's like, I got the old desk. I love that bit. She's got the old desk. Katrina Steiner. All those years ago, drawer still sticks on it. Arthur made it with his own hands. You know, he had some help. And she's like, no, that's not what he said. Like, well, oh, man. Good chapter. What's interesting is there was like a fork in time at the beginning of it because Katrina, there's like an event and the characters, because we were with like all four characters together. Remember?
Right.
Katrina, Melissa, Morgan, and Dan. And then they split off at the beginning of the chapter. Katrina took Morgan into her office, and remember, Melissa grabbed Dan, and they ran off to go dancing.
It's not really focused, but in like looking back, I feel like the big focus here, the big thing is the and you kind of hit on it, Aaron, the drop, the name drop, right? Katrina name dropping who she thinks is responsible for his brother's deaths. Yeah. That's the big, everything else going on this scene. It is important, right? But I think the big takeaway is Lestrade and Frederick Steiner, or as Katrina says it, Frederick Steiner and his puppet master.
His puppet master.
Lestrade.
Yeah.
And with that, we'll have to see how everyone else is enjoying the party in the next chapter.
Chapter 15. So we go back in time, right? I like to think that we actually, this is a movie, you actually see the same scene from before. It's like we get it from the same angle, but then the camera deviated before. It followed Morgan and Katrina. And this time we follow, Melissa and Dan, right? They went dancing. And then that's when the minister of protocol was like, very well, never mind. And he was like, play some music, go on, play some dance music. She's the Archon. I can't, I'm just a guy. So here we are. At the minister of protocol's insistence, the string quartet immediately began a waltz. Here we go. Dan says, it would be my distinct honor if you would accompany me to the dance. So we get a little dance scene, okay? Classic.
A waltz?
It's a waltz. I like it, he leads her out to the dance floor and they're just kind of getting situated. And he says to her, you realize, don't you, that there are literally dozens of people who would kill to be in my position? She says, that may very well be, Captain, but I would prefer not to deal with them. None of them would be as light on their feet or as agile as you are. And she asks him if the Fed sons teach dancing in their military academies. This is cute. Oh my God. I love Dan says, only at the New Avalon Military Academy. Albion and Warriors Hall frown on dance, though they do have excellent anti-armor classes. Oh, this is good. Actually, my mother insisted that all her children learn how to behave in polite company. And in my opinion, company comes no more polite. We just get this this little dancing. They're just talking to each other. It's cool because the last time we saw them together, how much interaction did they have in Unguard? Dan, he didn't really talk to her that much though, did he?
The only thing we really see is at the end of the book, right? True. Where he's standing over Patrick and Melissa's crying.
It's cool. They're dancing. We get this bit where Melissa thanks Dan for saving her. She expresses gratitude. Thank you so much. It's so great that you guys showed up. And unfortunately, this very pleasant moment they're having is interrupted when Melissa spots Baron Seffens approaching. Huh? Remember Seffens? Remember this? We've been here before. Baron Seffens is Duke Michael's ambassador to the Commonwealth Court, right?
Yeah, this is the one Andy squared off with.
Andy. Yeah, this is the guy Andy was talking to. More like salt to a slug, right?
Yes.
And so, Baron Seffens comes walking up, dude, and you're like, oh, here we go, right? Here we go. Let's go. Give me what we want. We got a cat fight. You know what I mean? It's about to get catty. I got real excited.
You can see it coming a mile away.
Yeah. Dan thinks, looks like another human rat from New Syrtis. And he's drunk. So listen, Seffens walks up. Dan says, I don't believe I've had the pleasure, though Baron's reputation precedes him. Basically, what I'm saying is that the vibes are atrocious. Right from the jump, Seffens walks up. Clearly, he goes on the attack. Also, Dan is obviously, he's not very receptive. They're both fairly, pretty rude to each other. Basically, they pop off immediately is what I'm saying there. Yeah. They're locked and loaded, right? They're ready to pop.
Hits him with the stanky leg.
Things escalate when the Baron asks Dan, he says, so Captain, is it an Allard family trait to abandon the Federated Sons? He becomes intentionally antagonistic right away. He just starts jabbing at him. Like, you know, and he goes straight for the, remember, this is what he hit last time, though. This is what he wanted to talk about Andy yeah. about. He's still thinking about Justin. He's like, I'm dying to talk about Justin. You're Justin's brother, aren't you? Andy got away from me.
He just can't do it in a way that anybody would actually want to have the conversation with him.
I like this. He plays it cool, though. Dan says, forgive me, Baron. I do not understand your inquiry. He's like, oh, okay. All right. Yeah.
That's like a head shake, heavy blink. Mm-mm. Excuse me?
Yes. Concerned glances. Yeah, Seffens is sloppy drunk, by the way. It says that multiple times. Yes. He comes up. He's like, he's faded. That's what's so funny. Dude gets blasted and at like the New Year's Eve party, and he sees Dan out, and he's like, Dan, is it a Allard family trait to abandon the sons? And Dan's like, what do you mean? I don't understand. God, yeah, he's nasty. He hissed his words, and a feral hatred showed in his eyes. He goes in on him, though, right? So I like what Seffens says here, or it's interesting. He explains himself by saying that Dan, he jumped ship first by having your daddy beg Hans Davian to assign you to the Kellhounds. The prince even gave you a Valkyrie as a going-away present. Then your brother left us after betraying the march and nearly getting his command killed in the process. And then he says, I just want to know which Allard is next. And this is interesting what he says here. Well, just in terms of the perception of, he accuses him of having his daddy beg Hans Davian to assign him to the Kellhounds. And remember, I mentioned that before, how he got that letter, right? Dan was special. He got a letter from the prince. You're like, oh yeah, it probably was Quintus who did it. You know, it might have been we floated anyway. I thought it was interesting. Oh, and the Valkyrie, right? Says he gave him a Valkyrie. That's that Valkyrie that he had. The one that blew up. Warrior on guard. He got it hooked on the Warhammer. Dan's getting so mad. He hasn't broke him yet, though. He's just eating. Just like grinding his teeth. he thinks to himself that Seffens is a hater because, specifically to him, he hates Allards because Hans is chill with Quintus and he's not chill with Michael. He feels like that Quintus replaced Michael's place in kind of the prince's inner circle, right? It's like, oh, that would be Michael would be there if like Quintus wasn't like out of the picture, even though like that's not true, right? Hans wishes that Michael was chill. Michael's the one who's like not being chill, right? He's just a hater is what he's saying. Oh, yes. Seffens is embarrassing himself. This man's sloppy. He's an embarrassment. What's he doing here? Unacceptable. Oh, I like this, though. This is where he starts to crack here. Says, Melissa started to speak, but Dan laid his left hand on her arm. Like, he's like, hold up. Hold up.
I got this. Yeah.
Let me cook, right? She's like, he's like, no, hold up. Get to it, Seffens. What's the real question you wanted to ask? And you're like, what? What is he getting at? Seffens hits back. He asked him, what do you captain suppose that question to be? Dan licked his lips. I think you want to know what it feels like to be Justin's brother, the brother of a traitor. And Seffens says, he like lays his, puts his like hand on shoulder, like exactly. And you're like, oh man, he really is. He's like, oh, he really is still hung up about Justin. He's such a hater. This guy's like a professional hater. So of course, oh dude. Dan just does this sick maneuver. What does he do here? He puts him in like a wrist lock or something. It's sweet.
It's literally a wrist lock. Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
The Baron touched him first, right?
Right.
Yeah.
But
totally justifiable.
I mean, at the Archon New Year's Eve party,
everyone agrees he was asking for it. Literally everyone. Okay. He's a greasy little rat. And yes. Someone needed to put him in his place.
I'm going to be honest. Dan probably shouldn't have done this.
But we have learned through these books so far that the Allards have a temper.
They have a bit of a temper. And this is what he wants.
Yeah.
Okay. Seffens was looking to start a fight. Well, he got not quite a fight, but
he did, though.
He's going to get
dunked on. He came looking for trouble. Right. Come on. He was like, this dude was asking for it.
I think Seffens was looking to fight a noble, and he messed up by choosing to fight a mech warrior here.
So that, and he like came over pretty quick. He went and found him on the dance floor. Right? Yeah. He was out hanging out with like this little slug man, right? It's like, I feel like when he saw Dan get introduced, he was like, yes, you know, dude, he must have been so hyped when he saw Dan come in. He had no idea, like, oh,
he's like, I'm going to dunk on this dude in front of everybody, in front of Melissa. It's going to be great.
Dan Allard. What a surprise. Yeah, it's cool. Dan puts him in a wrist lock and he says all these nice things about Justin. He says, I've always been proud of Justin. I envied him when he got into Sakaara. You know, every mech warrior knows Sakaara is awesome. He went to Sakaara Academy. I like this.
Anything but first class.
I want to go to Sakaara Academy. I like that. Is that in the Capellan March, right? I shouldn't have asked. I don't know why. I'm sick. You know, I'm sorry. I want to know. Where is the Sakaara? The colleges. Colleges. Is there a source book colleges?
It is actually in the Combine March, right on the board of the Combine March.
Oh. All right. Core word and a spin word. Terra. That's cool. I would totally go to college in the Draconis March, dude. That'd be so tight. And then you'd like go back to the Capellan March and you're like, dude, the food up there was so much better. You guys don't even know. I like this bit though, where he's like slowly applying. He's like increasing the pressure as he says like a more and more effusive praise for Justin's accomplishments, right? It's like, you want to know what it's like to be Justin's brother? He's like, and he's like, he was the best. He went to college. It was so cool. He got the AFFS commission. And Dan brings up his performance on Spica. Justin on Spica, remember? We've talked about this before. That was Candace Liao. She was on Spica, right? In the Vindicator. That was where Justin, he like won that medal. He had this whole thing. There was like this big heroic moment. Yeah, he was on Spica. He got a medal. That was his like a big, oh yeah, Dan like references it here, right? You can ask any mech warrior here what he or she thought of the plan Justin conceived and helped execute to rescue General Courtney's command, right? So he like saved the general on Spica. That's what Justin did. You know, was it reckless? Yes. Desperate? Yes. But it worked, right? That's what he says. It did work. And Justin got the Diamond Sunburst. It was awesome.
He hits him with like, he literally did what he had to do.
Yeah.
And that's something
he's cool.
You're not going to understand.
He's like, what's it like to be Justin's brother? It's sweet. That guy's cool. And it's sad what happened, but he's even like, you know, I kind of get it, right? This is not the first time where he's like, he got like dispossessed. He wasn't going to have a command. When you're a mech warrior, you do mech warrior stuff. It's in your blood. And this is where all the mech warriors are like nodding along like, he's right. Oh, he even brings up his Solaris records. He's like, and don't forget on Solaris, Justin won even when the other dude cheated. And I was like, yeah, dude, suck it, Capet.
It goes on like this for some time with Dan just absolutely wrecking Seffens.
Yeah.
It's like Dan reads the room. And yeah. This is the moment, like, as he's going through this, that you're like, man, him and Justin are related. He gives him, like, the full Capet treatment, where he's like, you started this show, and I'm finishing it.
That's what this feels like. These whole chapters also, they feel very reminiscent. They parallel the chapters of on Tharkad in the first Warrior book, right? Like these.
Yeah, it's the same characters.
The same characters getting.
Starting new beefs.
Getting smoked by other.
Yeah, that's what I mean. He's like this jobber. Right?
Getting, the noble jobber. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like these guys are just like, oh, we're going to go poke fun at these Fed Sun guys. And then they just rake them across the coals. And apparently he just keeps coming back for it.
Do you think like anytime a Fed Sun's rep shows up to Tharkad, Seffens like seeks him out and he's like, what's your thoughts on Justin? Doesn't he suck? Has anybody been like, yeah, he sucks. That's like warranted him to like continue this route? Because so far it's all been L's for him.
It's all been else. It's true. It's a bold strategy, cut. Let's see how many times you get
So eventually he lets him go. Says Dan released the Baron's arm and Seffens collapsed, clutching his painful limb to his chest. And that's when Dan tells him, Justin remained true to himself, true to his training and his life. He never abandoned the Suns. Yeah, he leaves him on the floor, right? He's just like, my arm, like on the floor. And then Dan just turns around, Oh, right. He turns to Melissa, of course. He says, "Forgive me, Highness, for being so rude." Oh, man. Yeah, he's about to. He's like, "I got to go. Dan." Yeah. He see there's like some French doors leading out to the gardens. He's like, yes, if you permit me, I need some air.
I think this is my stop.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have to go. Forgive me. I must leave. I appear to have just demolished Baron Seffin in the middle of the New Year's Eve ball on Parkhead.
Man, could you imagine how bad it would be to be the Lyran security detail at this party? And you're just watching the man who's the friend of the guy with the magic piece of paper go and just straight wrestle a dude to the ground. Yeah. And be like, what do we do here? what's the protocol? We're going to have to call this one in.
I'm going to be honest with you. Obviously not Dan and Morgan, but I'm sure Seffins is a known instigator.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sure. They are hard leaning on that deny this man nothing excuse to stand back and just watch.
Those guards probably have like a general order, like, listen, there's this guy, Seffin's photo on like a board in the back room. Like, he's going to cause trouble. As long as no one tries to kill him, just let it go.
Yeah.
Chill.
Once the punches start, count to a solid 10 before doing anything.
You don't want to assault him, right? You don't want to assault him. He makes you, right?
Yeah. It makes you. Everyone loses, right? Yeah, it's true.
Away, snail. Away.
Away.
Yeah. Terrible. It's wild. Yeah, Dan starts walking away. Seffins starts getting back up. He's like, "You'll pay for this, Alan. I swear you'll pay." And then so Dan like sweep kicks him. That's what it says.
Which, this is out of line. I'm sorry, Dan.
He sweep kicks him and he says, "Where, Viper? I may just cut the coin from your hide." And then he stalks off.
Which is a hell of a thing to say to somebody.
Yeah. I'm going
to
start saying this to dudes. Hey, Viper, I may just cut the coin from your hide.
It's a very Justin-esque line.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It's like you sweep kick the dude. You just wait for him to get back up.
He's been hanging with them hounds, though. He's got a little bit of that hound in him. That's what happens. He's been swashbuckling, right? Yep. He's out of control. Yep. He's not going to take it.
Here we are, kicking nobles.
Yeah. Arden Sortek would never, like, do, like, a wrist takedown on it, right?
Yeah.
He understands a little something called, public relations.
Yeah.
Also, if Arden Sortek's going to punch someone, I just assume it's a haymaker.
Yeah. This is if anything, this is a potential lawsuit, is what I'm thinking. Yeah. You gotta be careful with this kind of stuff. So, then we cut to, of course, Dan, like, alone in the garden. Reflective Dan.
In reflective it, he's got the flail out and he's beating himself for...
"You idiot. What were you doing in there?" Yeah. We got thick gray cloud covering. All right. It's New Year's Eve night on Tharkan. We're out here alone. And then he hears a voice. "You care very much for your brother, don't you?" He turns. This woman walks up. He gets a look. He's like, it's Melissa. And then no, it's not Melissa. He's like, no, sorry. She's like, "No, it's okay. Not the first person to make that mistake." She walks up and says, "What you said in there touched me. I thought maybe you'd like to talk to someone." You're like, "Oh, interesting. New character arrives. She looks like Melissa." No, she's not Melissa. Interesting.
It's Gina Clay.
It's Gina. It's Gina.
Which this is our first time seeing Gina from when she sat down across from Melissa before Melissa left on the Silver Eagle.
Yeah, when they were talking about the names.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. It's been a while. It's Gina. And she takes him down to the garden. She's like, "Come on, let's take a walk. Come on, bud. This is cool." Gina walks up to be like, "Hey, bud.
Listen, we see how this is going."
Uh-huh. Yeah.
This can, okay, knowing what Gina's role is here,
uh-huh.
This is trouble, right?
Work.
It's not just me, right?
This is
like,
work.
This is, it's going to be a problem.
She takes him walk around the garden. She asks him, "You idolized your brother, didn't you?" Dan's like, "Yeah, I did. I love this. Oh, yeah, Justin, you know, he's older than me. But then Dan got bigger than Justin. So Justin started calling Dan his big brother." Isn't that cute? They're actually half brothers because, you know, it's from his father's first wife. Oh, this is funny, though, right? This is where Gina says that, "Oh, you're so lucky. I was an only child." It's here that she tells him her name. Like, "I'm sorry, what's your name?" She says, "It's Gina." But yeah, he talks to Gina about his relationship with Justin. Just about basically kind of the same stuff he said in there to the Baron. He's like, Justin was the coolest. I just wanted to be just like him. I thought he was the coolest guy. He's my favorite guy.
But while he was in there speaking with Seffens, it was all about the like actions of Justin in the public knowledge.
Yeah,
where when like he's with Gina here, it's all the more personal connection he has Justin.
That's true. Good point.
Like he goes on to tell him about the story of when he was graduating the new Avalon Military Academy. And he's like, Justin took time like during the Liao assault to write me a letter. And it was short. It was a list of half dozen mechs.
Yeah, he wrote
graduation present at the top.
Graduation present. You had to pick one.
Justin said he'd shoot it, but I had to clean it up and fix it.
Yeah. Pick a mech, I'll shoot it out for you. You know?
Yeah. Just big brother stuff.
He's super cool. He's like, man, Justin was like so cool. Imagine having big brother Justin. And of course he blames himself. Of course, you know, the usual. He blames himself. Oh, if I was, you know, I wasn't there when he needed me. If I had been there, oh, you know, the usual. She tells him to stop torturing himself this way. She says, you've leaped to conclusions and allowed them to build upon themselves. And that's madness.
She's right.
Yes.
She's right. Oh, yeah. And they share an embrace, right? They have a little hug. She really opens him up. Clearly, he really needed this. Because he's like, oh, and he like holds her and he's like, why did he go to Solaris?
He did just put a nobleman in a wrist lock and then sweep kick him in a crowded ballroom. So, yeah, he did need this, I think.
He needed to talk. He did. He's like, I needed this. He's literally, he's like holding her like, why didn't he come to me? Why? He could have joined the Kellhounds, which is a good point. What's that timeline? I want, like, you know, give me the story where in an alternate timeline, where Justin joins the Kellhounds.
For sure.
Wouldn't that be sick? That'd be tight.
I do love how Stackpole stays so consistent with the people that were in Justin's life, how they were all in these positions where they couldn't decompress from Justin's situation. It was just like when we were on the Silver Eagle with Andy and the mention of somebody kind of challenging Justin's reputation sends him off the deep end and then finally gets a moment to talk about it. And the weight just comes out all at once.
Yeah. It's like she's sucking venom out of a snake bite.
Yeah. She's sucking him dry. Gina hears him out and she tells him though. I mean, she basically tells him, you know, you got to chill out though. Really, it's not your fault. Also, think about it. Maybe he went to Solaris to prove he was the best mech warrior. He's trying to prove himself. And Dan's like, sure, why does he got to prove himself in the Capellan Confederation, though? Am I right? Come on. You're killing me. I do love this, though. The chapter ends with Gina gives him, like, this little theory she has here, right? Listen, she explains to Dan that Justin is two natures, you see. Half Fed, half Capellan, okay? And when he lost access to one half of himself, he naturally tended toward the other half, the Capellan half. Strange as it sounds, I believe the other half must one day resurface. His Fed son's half. That's what she says. That Fetty will come back. He'll bounce back. He's not lost, is basically what she says.
What do we think of our two worlds, Justin? You know who I'm looking at here, Aaron, because Kanan knows. What do you think of this theory of Genus?
I think the way it's boiled down is a very simplistic approach to it, but
you're saying Gina has no nuance.
Yeah. Where it's just like, oh, well, he's half Fed son, half Capellan. When Fed sons don't work out, he's just Capellan now.
It's very funny. She's like,
it is a little black and white.
She defines the nature of the two halves. He's half Fed, half Capellan.
Yeah.
And then when he lost access to his Fed side, it's going to balance out. Right? It's gonna, like all things, like nature. Sure, maybe. I thought this was cool.
But I feel like the idea of what we're talking about with Justin here is that he's still seeking out that place for himself. And to what she's saying there, I think does ring true. But he's doing it very dangerously in that respect of he's setting himself up to have the same thing happen to him. He's put himself as a part of the machine in Capellan space just as he was in Fed Sun space.
Yeah.
And now he's even further tied to that after our Tai Chi in the Garden chapter with Candace. So it seems like he's still making the decision of where he's at. But right now, it feels natural for him to be in the position he's in.
You're saying it's a... So you're agreeing, kind of. It's a bit of a perpetual motion machine.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a back and forth.
Yeah, where Justin's letting his anger for the Fed Sons compromise his decision making into going right back into the same problem that he encountered before.
Wait, I don't understand. I'm sorry. Like, when you say the same situation as before, what's being compared? In terms of, you mean like his old life to his new one?
Yes, but where his kind of, I would call it blind loyalty to the Fed Sons put him in a position to be a sacrificial pawn.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Now he's serving that role, but in even a greater
capacity.
Exactly. Yeah. For Liao, and we've already seen Maximilian pulls and pushes on Justin a lot in that position.
Yeah.
It's a real, like, Newton's cradle situation. It's like sitting on someone's desk. You, like, move the one ball over and it knocks the others.
Yeah, well, and actually, I think that's a good example because only the two sides on the end are moving. And he's exactly. Not actually addressing what's in the middle, which is who Justin is.
Interesting. I'm glad Kanan had you elaborate.
They have to join back together to be reunited.
He has to be whole.
Yeah. He needs to become Justin Allard Ziyang.
Exactly.
No, I do need to point out, the chapter ends with Dan verbalizing the concern that if Justin does not ever come back in that way, embrace his Fed side again, back to the old me, then in that case, more than anything, he becomes a very dangerous foe. Right. He and you're like, oh, yeah, good point.
Yeah.
Dan realizes if Justin is an enemy, then like that's scary because he's actually good. Right.
Yeah.
That's the last thing we need right now.
And I feel like Stackpole does such a good job in this chapter setting up that final line that all this outburst and emotion behind it stems from that sentence that Dan wants all of this. He talked so much about Justin's abilities. He talked about how what we appear to see or what I inferred from what Dan was saying, Dan sees Justin as his better, his older brother that he is trying to work to be as good as. And if Justin doesn't come back, then he's better than him in a fight that Dan can't fight him on. Dan wouldn't be able to, not just in the ability, but emotionally fight him on.
Yeah. Right.
And, but I also think when we then take it and kind of flip it into Justin's perspective, this is the part that I was so excited for in the epilogue of Warrior On Guard.
Yeah.
That it's like, oh, you've got these two brothers that are now circling each other.
Yeah.
And that, well, I think, makes this so interesting to follow up on. Like, this part is such a great plot thread to keep pulling on, that either their relationship is going to be something that tethers both of them into understanding or conflict.
Two brothers divided by fate. Will they face off against each other on the battlefield?
Oh, it's like that John Woo movie, Face Off.
Face Off.
Oh, wait, those aren't two brothers.
Yes.
Right. That's actually, they're two different people entirely, and they
They switch faces.
Caster Troy.
The specialist.
It's a wild movie, John Woo, wherever you are. It's a wild one.
But with both Dan and Morgan feeling the weight of this party, there's still time till the party's over. We'll have to see how things carry on in the next chapter.
Chapter 16. So we open with Dan and Gina still out in the garden. However, the chapter starts with an agent coming to collect Dan. This guy comes in and says that, excuse me, Captain Allard, but the Archon and Colonel Kell are returning to the party. Okay, so Gina says she'll catch up with them later. Dan goes with the agent. So, he attempted to escape the party. He has now been hunted down. He's now been asked to return to the party. So back in. He's going back in.
Just when I thought I was out.
Yeah, literally.
When I first read this, I was like, oh man, they're coming for him for sweep kicking that noble.
Everyone was happy about that.
Yeah.
That was Baron Sevens. And you're allowed to hurt Baron Sevens. Everyone knows this.
One free sweep kick.
Yeah. So Dan gets back to the party. And it's funny because when he first walks in, he's like, oh, I see him over there. I see where Morgan is hanging out with Katrina. By the time he gets over there, Katrina's gone, which is funny. He's like, oh, she's just gone. She disappeared somewhere. And it's just Morgan now. And he realizes that Morgan is talking to these dudes. Dan found Morgan engaged in conversation with three men. They don't even look like they're having a great time. So Dan walks up. And immediately, Morgan is kind enough to make some room for him. He asks Dan if he's met these gentlemen before. Yeah, Dan pulls up. He introduces himself. Who do we got? First up, we got, there's an elderly man, okay? Platinum hair, gray eyes. He's got a thin scar running up from the corner of the right eye. Definitely a Steiner, just genetically, it says. He just looks like a Steiner.
They're just built different.
They are. And Dan knows this guy, though. He knows him on sight. He says, I am honored to again meet you, Duke Frederick. So, Frederick Steiner's here. You remember Frederick, Duke of Duran.
Yep,
Duke of Duran.
He got into it with Arden, right? Oh. Wasn't that when Arden Sortek was here? Yeah.
That was Frederick and Lestrade.
Yeah. Oh, they're back.
Decided to go toe-to-toe with Arden.
Now, they get to talking, and Frederick mentions Dan's role in the Silver Eagle incident, right? He tells him, he understands he deserves no small amount of credit in the Silver Eagle rescue. However, Dan maintains that he merely did what had to be done, right? Anyone would have done it in the same situation. This is where Duke Aldo Lestrade comes limping forward, hand extended, and Lestrade tells Dan, spoken like a true hero, Captain, your modesty becomes you. Unfortunately, for Duke Lestrade, Dan knows bait when he sees it, right? He doesn't bite. He doesn't like it. So there's a third man here as well. Dan gives him a once-over. He says, this guy kind of looks like a Steiner. Like, eyes are too dark, though. These dark, beady eyes. I don't know. This guy looks like a schemer. There's this other guy here. He introduces himself. And the third man says, I am Ryan Steiner. So we got Frederick Steiner, Duke Lestrade, and Ryan Steiner, and Morgan Kell, and Dan Allard. They're all here.
Yep.
On Tharkad.
The Tharkad goon squad is back again.
They're ready to talk trash. They've been waiting. They've rehearsed some lines. They've been working on their bits.
They said their affirmations in front of the mirror. I am brave.
I will take down a fed son.
It should be noted that Ryan is the Duke of Parima, and he's Duke Frederick's. Actually, this is Morgan who says this. Morgan says that he knew Ryan's mother, actually. Donna Steiner. She taught at the Nagel Ring. He was even one of the honor guards for the ceremony. We got some, there's a little, character history here. Ryan Steiner, everyone. There's another guy. We're not done yet, though, because before we can even really get into it, Morgan's words trail off into Arctic silence as another man joins the group. And so they all turn, and we see this haggard, gray-haired man come walking up when he sees Morgan. I like this. This dude comes up. He sees Morgan. So it is true, he said in a gravelly voice. The dead walk among us again. They love this. They're like, oh my God, it's Morgan. It's like you're back from the dead, my man. Yes, another Lyran nobleman. I can't wait.
They're just coming out of the woodwork. Did they got any more tucked away?
Morgan Kell is a Lyran nobleman, but he's cool. They're not all bad.
Just these ones.
Yeah.
It's weird. They all seem to be from like the same area, like the Isle of Sky. It's weird.
The Skyrim.
Skyrim, yes. Yes. Who's the head of that?
Todd Howard.
Todd Howard.
Todd Howard. That's right. That's right. Todd Howard. He would be a Lyran for sure.
Tiberius. Stormcloak.
Stormcloaks. Yeah. Snow.
Yeah, dragons.
dragons, horns on helmets,
Parthenax,
magic dudes with face masks, Yetis,
lusty Argonian maids, you know, the works.
You don't want to join the Blades? No, dude, I don't want to join the Blades. There's like two of you. Yeah, we got katanas.
They got katanas, dude.
So, this old man comes walking up, refers to Morgan as having come back from the dead. I love this. Morgan hits back. Do you speak of yourself, Alessandro Steiner, or do you refer to me? Oh, but I forget my manners. What's the proper form of address for a deposed Archon again?
Morgan strikes first.
Morgan strikes first, and this is Alessandro Steiner. And it would seem that he used to be Archon, but he is Archon no longer. Okay? So, which that
sounds like
cool.
There's a story.
I feel like most people who used to be Archon don't get to go on and have lives after, like not being the Archon, right? Usually that's the...
Yeah, not a good retirement package after that.
It's usually your last title.
I think you're just happy to have a pulse.
Yeah.
Really.
So I'd say he's lucky. Yeah, Morgan strikes first. Alessandro likes it. He's like, ooh, spicy today.
Fun fact, Alessandro Steiner was the 28th Archon of the Lyran Commonwealth.
The more you know.
So that means that Katrina's the 29th.
Indeed.
So this was the Archon previous that they mentioned that orchestrated the assassination tip on Polsbo, right?
Exactly. This is the guy. There's this whole conflict. They talk about it a little bit. I read some stuff in a source book. I did. I looked some stuff up. And there's some stuff about this guy. However, Morgan takes a shot at him. And I like this. He shoots right back. He's like, oh, pretty good. You always were quick, Morgan Kell. I like he points at the other Lyran nobleman, Frederick and Lestrade. He's like, you know, thank God neither of these two have your wit and intelligence, right? If they had even half of it, there's a good chance that any one of their various multiple plots could have secured them the throne. But they're dumb. So they got no chance. You know what I mean? And I'm like, yes, let's go. Let's go.
They're just dragging it out in the middle of the room.
These guys, they all hate each other so much.
Yep. Frederick and Aldo literally just caught strays just by being around this conversation.
Masterful technique here on
yes.
display. Yeah, they almost look angry for a second. I like that it says, they get dangerously close to looking like offended, but then they're like, no, no, don't let them see it.
We should feign innocence is the way they say it.
We're fine.
And it's just like, these two are too dumb. And then it's just like, I wonder if he's talking about us.
I do like when Alessandro says that about Frederick and Lestrade, though. Morgan pushes back, right? Morgan tells Alessandro that, personally, he finds his thesis flawed, okay? Because for with wit and intelligence goes a fierce loyalty. The sense of justice that is on Wealthstrongen's foundation, huh? And basically, Morgan tells him that smart people don't intentionally destabilize their own region in pursuit of social status. That's actually not a thing that, like, intelligent people do generally. So, just so you know, it's like leans in on him. What's wrong with you people?
Yeah.
Now, it should be noted that when Morgan says that, he uses Alessandro's first name. He says... Alessandro. So, in a masterful, again, deflection, here we go. We're on another subject right away. Alessandro stiffens and says, I don't recall, Colonel Kell, ever giving you leave to speak with me with such familiarity. You see, we get this bit where Alessandro chastises Morgan for presuming that they're on a first-name basis. However, Morgan reminds Alessandro that they've been on a first-name basis ever since he helped Katrina remove him from the throne. Remember that? We won.
Yes.
So yeah, I can call you Alessandro. And he makes sure to throw it on. Don't ever forget, I'm not afraid to do it again. All right? Okay? But yeah, this is the guy. This is the same guy that, yeah, Morgan back in the day, he worked with Katrina to kick him out. And they were successful,
you know what?
Too.
I'm going to give this guy points for even coming over to talk to Morgan. Like, homie got usurped by this swashbuckling mercenary, and he doesn't just hide from him in the corner. At least he comes to get dunked onto his face. So he's still, yeah,
he came out. He came out to New Year's to get dunked on.
Yeah. I will say, out of our noble goonery, Alessandro is the one that has stood closest to toe-to-toe in these conversations and has kept his feet. No one's sweet kept him yet, so.
But, I mean, where is Dan?
Yeah.
So, Duke Lestrade hears this. Hears Morgan say something very reasonable. He's shocked, though. Shocked and appalled by such an outrageous demonstration of morality on the part of Colonel Kell. He tells Morgan, you know, Morgan, all that time in the desert really fried your brain. You know what I mean? All that time in the desert. You've lost it, dude. He doesn't even know what he's talking about.
No. I love right before he says that, he goes to like jam a finger in Morgan's chest and he hits the metal it like reflects badge. Light into his eyes. And he's like,
How embarrassing.
Desert. It's like he lost before he even started talking.
Fried your brain. Also, he just wants to get it straight.
He's just said he can't pull off the loincloth.
He can't. He wants to clarify. All right, don't get me wrong. He says he is personally insulted by any accusation of perceived disloyalty to the Commonwealth on his part, all right? That's not him. He's Duke Lestrade, okay? He just doesn't think the Archon cares about the welfare of his people, right?
Like he didn't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, Morgan brings up a good point here, because Lestrade is always going on about how he's not getting any help. Defense-wise, they're leaving the Isle of Skye out there. We're so unprotected. We're getting raided all the time, nonstop. I don't even have any worlds left. It's insane. We're like, it's turned into a complete madhouse. And Morgan leans in and says, quick question, though. Tell me, okay? So if your holdings are always under attack and Zanaya is within your holdings, how come it never got attacked? Like, the whole time I was there, for 11 years, I didn't see a drop ship. So, I just thought you should know, Zanaya's safe, okay?
Coincidence? You be the judge.
This is where Lestrade reminds Morgan that, well, he's been in a monastery for 11 years, and a lot of stuff has happened since then.
This used out one tune.
Yeah.
He keeps hitting the monastery angle.
You've been in that monastery. Listen, things have changed, though. Check this out, Morgan. For example, when Chara 3, remember that? Recently came under attack by Combine forces. You know what happened? The Kellhounds abandoned the world. That's what happened. And you must see where I'm coming from, right? It seems like the Archon only sends incompetent merc companies these days. Considering the alternatives, it's only right. It's only right to protest such treatment. Listen, Morgan doesn't think Lestrade is funny, by the way. He's not buying it.
I love how, like, Alessandro immediately is like, yeah, get him. And he turns over and looks at Morgan, and he's like, uh-oh, this isn't going to go well.
Deeply.
He's got that look in his eye.
Deeply unamused. Right. This shit's not funny.
Yeah.
I feel a sweep kick coming on.
Yeah, when Dan turns over and looks at Morgan, and he sees, he's like, he's got that look in his eye. It's just like when he was on Mallory's World, and we learned that our battalion would be hosting the 2nd Sword of Light Regiment, and no support could reach us.
This is the scene I want shot by Tarantino, and I want him to hit him with the Kill Bill, like, pew, 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 like
zoom in on the feet?
Zoom in, no, not the feet, the face. Like, I want like a direct, like, front silhouette of Morgan Kell.
Speaking of Dan, I thought it was funny. Dan is here. So I read this whole chapter, I took my notes on it and stuff, as I do, and I realized while reading my notes, I didn't write anything about Dan. I actually was like, oh, doesn't this chapter start with Dan joining this conversation? He's not in it, though. He's just standing there the whole time, watching these dudes kill each other.
I think he had enough of of verbal jousting for one day.
He does not participate. Smartly.
It's very funny.
Dan Allard just walks up. This scene is he walks up and just stands there and nods along, hands in pockets, right? Just like,
He straight up walked into this and put himself in timeout. He's like, listen.
A smart man.
Yeah.
Now, Lestrade brings up the monastery And so this is where, listen, Morgan expresses this thought. He is certain that Alessandro's own period of exile on Ferrillo is certainly must have imparted a similar realignment of perspective, just as Morgan's time on Zenaya has affected him, right? You were in a monastery. I heard, weren't you exiled, taking a little time? Listen, the thing is, you know, I don't think Alessandro's situation was quite as voluntary as Morgan's was.
It does seem like his exile was violent.
Yeah, they did the landed gentry thing where, you know, we like locked you in your summer house or whatever. Oh, I also love this bit where Morgan gives Lestrade this short lesson on like karmic debt, basically. It's beautiful. It's very like chaos theory. But, you know, it's also like the problem with you is that you suck. And so, you know, stuff that sucks keeps happening to you because that's how this works. But I'm cool, so cool stuff happens.
That's how it all works.
You know what I'm saying? Dang. He's right, though.
So that homie comes out and he's literally like, could have chose any flavor and you chose salty old man.
You see, Bren, given enough time, one learns to see all the subtle interconnections in this life, okay? Listen, my friend, each creates echoes, much like the ripples on a pond, huh? Huh? And everything comes back to haunt or to reward a person. Hmm? Often, the consequence of an action is magnified many times when it returns. That's what Morgan says to these guys in the middle of this conversation. He's like, real quick, let me keep it real quick, though. And he busts this out on him.
Yeah, it's all right there. Morgan just gives it to him. He gives them everything they need to know right there. It almost seems like it's for Nye, right? Like, he's like, these fools aren't going to listen to me.
No.
He tells them anyway, you could be better.
See, in my time away, I enriched myself, okay? In spirit. All right, what did you do?
I've gone to a music festival before, too. It's pretty rad.
Morgan's talking trash about Alessandro. He's going in on Lestrade. Don't forget about Frederick, who is also still here. And he is getting visibly confused by all the big words, right? So much so, in fact, apropos of nothing, he declares that he is not a politician. All right, let me get one thing straight. All right, I'm not a politician, okay? And he detests word games.
I do like how he refers to them as word games, even though, like, the last thing that was said was Morgan was like, you could choose to do anything, but you booked a room in the Quality Inn.
Yeah.
a throwback.
This man, he's a military leader, and he says he's not a politician, he doesn't love word games. But I feel like our experience as the reader has been mostly him being a politician and engaging in word games.
That's right? Exclusively how we've interfaced with Frederick Steiner, yeah. In his defense, that's just what we've seen.
Yeah, we've been at two parties. This is Party Fred, right?
Yeah.
I'm just starting to learn that when somebody in the BattleTech universe says, I'm not a politician or I don't like politics, it's just like the bless their heart moment where they're just going to say a really hot take after that.
It's just like
they're about to say something wild. Yeah.
We will make these statements over and over again. I'm thinking of a specific character with a V that also doesn't like politics.
Now, he does issue a little bit of a warning here at the end. He implores Colonel Kell to please speak plainly, because I hate word games, remember?
Even though homie just gave him the plainest of plain spoken words, he laid it out like clear as day. And Frederick's like, what's this foreign language you're speaking? We already did this, didn't we?
But yeah, basically, Frederick, he advises Morgan to not say anything he can't take back. You know, let's be careful with our a sharp tongue. And then after hearing this, a smile blossoms on Morgan's face. He says, amazing, nodding to Aldo Lestrade. I didn't even see your lips move.
In case anyone's confused about that, he's calling him a puppet.
A puppet. Exactly. Why is this dude talking for you, basically?
Yeah, I love how Morgan immediately is just like, I know how to get this dude. I'm just going to disregard him. I'm not even going to like acknowledge this guy just spoke to me.
You have to like juggle them, right? You can't like focus fire on one. You have to like target one, hit him. You got to be cycling between targets. kind of as you're going along.
You can't let any of their heat dissipate.
Yeah.
You can't let any of them get the cooldowns back up.
Very difficult. This is where Morgan lays it out right. He explains it for Frederick. He keeps it simple. And he tells him straight up. He's like, honestly, Fred, you know, you're a legit good military leader. The 10th Lyran Guards, they're a great unit. I like he butters them up first. And it goes so far. I do like someone notices it's like his mood. Frederick's mood is shifted radically because he got some compliments. They're just like, God.
Remember, get yourself some boys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Somebody that'll tell you that's a nice jacket from nice time to time.
Morgan's telling him, though, you know, Frederick, you said it yourself. You're no politician, right? That's not what you do. That's what Lestrade's here for. You're right. You're not a good politician. And also, you're not being honest with yourself, right? None of us are. You guys aren't that great. Not only that, you know, we all know it. The throne would kill you. Okay, you couldn't handle it. The noble houses, they'd pick you clean. Okay? And, you know, nothing short of a brutal civil war coming out of a power vacuum seems like the most likely outcome, right? That's probably the only way that would go. And it's so savage.
Yes.
He did. To be clear, Frederick specifically asked Morgan Kell to say it plainly to him.
Yeah. He's like, just give it to me real,
he got what he asked for.
Real straight. And he's like, okay, well, the problem is you're not very good at this.
He hits him with like, evidence A, you don't want to be a politician. Evidence B, you're hanging around people that want to make you a politician. It ain't going to add up, son.
You're a good military leader, but all this politics is just going to flush all that down the drain. And all of a sudden, that funny blue uniform of yours is going to look pretty silly.
This is where
a red blood stain on it.
Yeah. Frederick, he got him. Frederick chewed on his lower lip, but made no reply. Feeling the scar, opened his mouth to say something, then seemed to think the better of it. Ladies and gentlemen, we got him. All right.
Got him.
That's a victory. That's called a takedown.
One down.
Yes.
Frederick takes the L, though. But now we got to change targets.
We look over at Aldo Lestrade. He's over there. Jowl's quivering with fury. And Frederick takes a moment because Lestrade is literally shaking right now. And because he's outraged. He's outraged. This is an outrage. How can this man be speaking to me this way? He reminds Morgan that the Lestrade family is so much more noble and important than his family will ever be. And his reputation shall not be tarnished by some minor world mercenary. I'm a Lestrade, okay? He starts pulling the, like, social hierarchy.
The L card.
Yeah. Now, upon hearing this, Morgan hears him out, and he wonders if Lestrade is beginning to believe his own myth. Right? How funny is this? You know, he's like, I mean, after all, you paid such good money for all those revisionist histories.
Uh-huh.
All those ghostwriters.
It's a lot of propaganda to just throw down the drain.
He's like, this guy, he's a survivor, right? You guys want to know what's really wild? What are the chances that literally everyone in the line of succession ahead of Aldo all met with unfortunate fates, untimely deaths, all of them? All along the line. What are the chances? Just saying, you're a survivor, buddy. You're going to make it.
I love how when we first got wind of this, it was from Arden, who kind of danced around it just enough to set Lestrade off. But Morgan comes in and he's just like, don't you think it's wild that even you're believing the lie that after you killed all your family and everything, that you somehow were innocent of it? And it's just like, man, Morgan, he knew that it was time to start shutting these dudes down.
He closes out that part by looking at him and says, remember, Lestrade, what you have done will come back to haunt you. Your father, my brother, the blood on your hands will drown you. Okay, Lestrade? Okay? All right? I'm like, oh my God. Like, he's scaring him, right? Now he's I was like, damn, dude.
It's almost a threat. Also, he's kind of like, see my previous statement
exactly.
On karma.
Yeah. And you know that's the line, that Morgan came here to engage with these guys to get out there. Because he came straight from the Archon, who said, by the way, Lestrade has his hands very deep in all the events that led up to your brother's death.
It's his fault.
And the next scene we get with Morgan is him standing in a courtyard talking to Lestrade and the rest of the goon squad.
There it is. Yeah.
Now, we'll never know where this conversation would have gone from here, because the appearance of Franklin Hecht, remember, that's the director of Protocol.
The mob.
The mob, yeah. Franklin shows up. This prevents Lestrade from any further riposte. It says riposte right there.
It does.
I slapped.
I marked it.
Yep.
Yeah.
they said the title of the movie.
Yes. So the minister arrives. He's here to gather Morgan and Dan. The Archon requests their presence, okay? We got to get him out of here. It's a bit of a extraction, I think they call this. It's like an extraction scenario. And so...
it's a protocol op.
Yeah. So the minister just takes him. He's just like, sorry, I got to take these guys. It's been fun. Holler at you. And then they're all just standing there while like...
with their pants down, metaphorically.
They're like, they just get away with it? Yes. So... I like when they're walking with the minister, though, and they're like, man, thanks, dude. Good luck. You know, timely intervention. Appreciate you.
It almost feels like he didn't want another sweep kick.
Yeah. These lines are great.
That's literally what he says here.
Yeah.
He comes in with the, like, no one minded your rough handling of Perrin Seffens earlier.
Literally no one. We loved it.
Yeah. But I could not let a similar situation develop between the Colonel and Aldo Lestrade.
Right. Because that's like a legit problem. Like that could be like an international incident. Right. That's literally.
Listen, everybody could take a shot at Seffens.
He came down there. He's like, you can't sweep kick Lestrade. I know. It would just cause problems. Okay.
We can't have the Isle of Skye rebel.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like how Morgan's response to it is just like, why is he that powerful? And it's like, that was the thought of like, oh, I was going to sweep kick him.
I do love how it describes the minister as a, like a schoolmaster carting boys off toward detention. That's true. I love that. Like, come on, boys.
This is the longest workday of his year.
Yeah.
No. This is a Lyran ball. Okay. Like, yeah. This is a pretty standard fare for this man. This is probably actually maybe a little more eventful, but not too out of the ordinary.
Now, he also brings up that if they would have had a big confrontation there, just then, right? Especially, you know, we got cameras around. There's paparazzi. You never know who's watching, who's recording. If something had gone down there, sure. People here, you would have come out looking almost certainly justified. But over there... the video will tell a different story, if you will. You know, it's not going to help. It doesn't help. All right. It just makes it worse. So don't sweep kick him, please.
Keep your sweep kicks to yourself.
Trust me. All right. You don't want media coverage in the Isle of Skye. All right. You just got to trust me on this one.
Sweep kicks don't play well there.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know about you guys. It feels like this Isle of Skye business is going to be important.
It really does. This comes up, like, so often, especially in these books, because you're dealing with the Lestrades.
It's shown up numerous times already.
Hmm.
But I'm sure that's all Stackpole has to say about that, so.
What can you do?
Not sweep kick him.
The minister leads Dan and Morgan up to where Katrina and Melissa are hanging out, right? They're going to rein in the new year. Katrina apologizes to Morgan for... dragging him away from his little battle there. But she convinces him, listen, no one wants to greet the new year with those losers. It's much better to be up here with us. Because, you know, I'm basically the queen. It's cool. Come hang out with me. So they do. They're chilling. Morgan's got some champagne. They're in the executive suite. We learn Melissa has something she wants to ask Morgan. She's being a little cagey about it. She gets his attention. Well, Melissa explains that she never really did know her father. Because he died just about 6 months after her birth. All she has are holographs and vids and the stories Morgan and Patrick tell about him. So upon hearing this, Morgan just gives her a big hug and tells Melissa that he would have been proud of her. Like, oh, okay, where's this going? And we learn quickly. Melissa asks Morgan if he would give her away at her wedding, right? Of course he accepts. He says it would be the greatest honor of his life. At that moment, the palace's clock tower began to ring with the first of 12 peals to announce the new year. And this is it. You know, we're lifting the sparkling champagne. Everyone got their glasses in the air. 3028, here we come. We made it.
A fine vintage.
Katrina, she asked for the usual, you know, may the year be filled with love, health, happiness. And we cut to Morgan, who's still, he says he's literally like eyeing Aldo Lestrade in the crowd. And Morgan says, and justice, Archon. Plenty of justice. Oh no, dude. He's going to mess this guy up.
That's how 3028 rings in.
Yeah.
In Tharkad.
We were there.
It was dope. However, there's those things, now that we've covered so much of these books, you start to get those stackpole senses. When you read a sentence and you're like,
yeah,
this is a thing now.
This is a thing now. Yes.
As soon as Melissa turns to Morgan and says, would you give me away at the wedding? You're like, stackpole, I see you got something cooking here.
He's like, I got to write it. This chapter's cool. This is another like grumpy Lyran senator ballroom scene. We got one of these in the first book. And now we get another run at it with like mostly the same characters. At least two of the
yes.
two different heroes, but
dunking on them.
The Tharkad noble goons here hit both Arden and Morgan with like the same lines, and they lost the argument both times. No adjustments.
They need better material.
Yeah.
NGs or noble goons, they need to work on their act.
Get a tight five, like, going for your argument here. Start working the crowd a little bit. Do something, but they're not doing themselves any favors.
They're not doing anyone any favors, is what it seems like.
I love these catty chapters. As soon as Stackpole's like, and we're in a big, grand room, and here comes the nobles, I get excited.
Stackpole does love his politics. It's true. You're in for some treats. Aaron will be well fed off of these. He will get nourishment from these books. I'll give you that.
Yes.
Oh, I have a feeling I'm going to be straight up fat by the end of this.
Fat, as in fully appreciating text.
Thank you. I meant very large.
Oh, okay. Well,
rotund on all this nourishment.
Well, you'll never be able to fit in that rotunda like that.
Don't take away my love.
And these dudes, these Lyrans, right? Like, what's up with these guys? They just stand about these balls just being like annoying. They're not trying to change anyone's mind or anything. They're just like, oh, I bet I can get this guy fired up. Let me go say some things.
This is something that the Lyran Commonwealth is known for. They call them social generals, right? They're nobles who command forces, but they really, they're not always the best for the job.
Yeah.
But Morgan did compliment Frederick. He was like, hey, you're no politician, but he was also like, you're no social general either. So you got that going for you.
They're so catty. But, you know, here we are. It's 3028, which is, I think that's a pretty important Battletech year. So like Price of Glory that we read, the Helm Memory Core stuff and whatnot, that hasn't happened yet, right?
Yeah, but we're getting closer to syncing up that timeline.
We're getting closer. It is. Yeah.
We're getting closer.
I like that. That's cool.
But with this chapter wrapping up our episode here, I think it's important to point out that this entire episode that we're covering is just this party. Five chapters of this party.
Yeah.
Big party.
And I actually really like that Stackpole wasn't afraid to change the pace of his writing. He didn't follow the beats of the first book. And one thing that really stood out to me as we start the second part here is that we're not building towards the next big mech battle. In the first book, we always had the next Solaris fight coming up. We always had that kind of on the edge of the next chapter coming up.
Yeah.
There's no palate cleanser in between these five chapters. It does go up and down. We get high emotions followed by comedic sword fighting with words. But yeah, there's nothing to break it up. This is the action.
Yes. And as I thought about that idea, and as I read through the beginning of the second part, I was thinking about how mentally this felt like it was preparing me that the big event of this book has been touted to be the wedding. And he's setting up the vocal, noble combat that's happening at this ball to still keep that tension that we would get out of some of the mech battles, some of the Solaris fights that we saw, to keep us in that mindset to be ready for that event. And I just, for me, thought that was really a smart way to do that. Instead of cutting to an action sequence in the middle of this, it was just to keep rolling with it, to keep pressing forward in the social, political drama of it all.
So what are you guys thinking? One continuous shot from start to finish, all five chapters?
You'd have some breaks. I'm down for like a low break.
Yeah. We got the split off. We got the Archon office visit. We got the Dan dancing with Melissa.
You definitely have to have that, like, that chandelier eye view of the waltz going on. Like, you're right. We'd have to have cuts.
Yeah. But I feel like all these chapters, all five of these chapters, were very distinct in the tone that was pressed through them.
It's obvious where he stopped them all intentionally, he got to what he needed to accomplish, and then that was the end of the chapter, and it's pretty clear why all of those things were in that chapter.
Yeah, and I like how, as I finished this chapter, it felt like he knew the pacing was spot on it, because one more chapter, I think, would have been too much.
I agree.
And it just felt like just the right amount to be pulled out of the action mindset and into the political mindset. But because of that, I really enjoyed it. Down to the differences between Dan and Seffin's conversation to Morgan and the Frederick and Lestrade conversation.
There are parts where I feel like it does linger a little bit, but I'll be honest, like, looking at it, I don't know where I would cut anything. And so, as per usual, the efficiency of words used on page is, well, it's what we've come to expect from Michael Stackpole.
Yeah. And it does a great job of also humanizing Morgan a little bit more. Since we've been introduced to such an important character in this overall story that we're just now getting to understand, Stackpole makes the most of that here.
By this point, we really do feel like we've seen all of the different faces of Morgan Kell, right? We saw him in self-proposed exile. We've seen him deeply saddened, angry, caring. Like, we've gotten a feel of how the man reacts and experiences all of his emotions and how he lets that reflect on himself out in the world. You're right. We really, it almost feels like it's the Morgan Kell speed run of this is this character, but it's done in an enjoyable manner, right?
Well, one of the really subtle things about it that I thought, and let me know if I was reading too much into this, but through these five chapters, if you take Dan's introduction with Morgan in the monastery, it was combative. It was distrustful. It was anger. Each chapter, a little bit more of that's let go by Dan. In the very first one with the note, he's second guessing almost everything Morgan's doing. He's cautious to seeing more of an inspiration out of him, seeing the composed Morgan and looking at him and saying, I remember this guy, to the final chapter where he feels like he's following him at that point. He stands by him through the argument, but doesn't question his actions through it. He looks at him and he sees more confident interpretations in his thoughts.
I personally don't think Dan's completely on board even now. However, I do what you said does have merit in my eyes, especially since we were joking at the time. But the fact that Dan didn't rush to his aid during the jousting between all those Lyra nobles, I think if Dan had felt that his friend, despite their differences, well, most of those differences were expunged in explanation, but we've seen the cut of Dan's jib, if you will. And, yeah. And You know, I really do think that if he thought Morgan couldn't have handled himself, he would have stepped in. And so I do think you're right. I do think there is more confidence in Morgan Kell placed by Dan. I don't know if we're completely out of the woods yet.
No. Well, I completely agree with you here because I feel like Stackpole would save the total confidence. He can't be totally confident in Morgan until he sees him with the Kell Hounds again. But I feel like that's, and this is me imposing an idea of what Stackpole's trying to do with it, is if they left the monastery and went straight to the Kell Hounds, it would not have made sense for Dan to be a mediator between the Kell Hounds and Morgan. We've seen the emotions. We've got Salome. We've got Kat Wilson. We've got these people that were deeply hurt by Morgan. And the hostility, if they all reacted the same way Dan did, it feels like there would almost be a revolt from the Kell Hounds rejecting Morgan outright. This puts Dan, to me, in a position to help keep things together, the same thing that Morgan validated Dan in when he spoke with him at the monastery. I believe that was what you were meant to do. That's what you were capable of, was keeping the Kell Hounds together.
Like I said, I think the framework is there.
Yeah, he's providing a path to the eventual end.
Indeed. And it is, I would, it's subtle.
Yeah.
But I do think there is something there.
And we'll have to find out how the new year kicks off next week when we continue on Warrior Riposte.
This was another episode of Mechs and Men. I am Cannon Hill, and I was joined, as usual, by my two good friends, Brent and Aaron. We would like to thank the writer, of course, Michael A. Stackpole, and all the other writers and artists who work so hard to keep Battletech alive. We would like to thank Catalyst Game Labs for being such generous stewards of the property. We have an email, advice@heat.management. If you have any questions, corrections, advice@heat.management.
Also, feel free to join us over on the Valhalla Club Discord channel. We've had a great time hopping in and playing games with y'all, getting to talk with you. You have all been amazing that have hopped in and joined in with us. So it's a great time over there. A lot of great fans, content creators, all gathered there, having a good time. The link will be in the description of the episode.
Also, speaking of Discord, make sure to hop over to the WolfNet Discord channel, as one of the WolfNet podcast hosts, Tommy Silent Sea Raven, is currently hosting a silent auction with some painted up miniatures that are each being put up to raise money for the Extra Life charity. So if you'd like, go hop over there, put a bid in, and help raise some money for a good cause.
We will return next week to continue our discussion of Warrior Riposte by Michael A. Stackpole.
Till next time.
Laylah.